You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people matter. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, we will be speaking with and listening to the music of Tom Nielsen. He has received over 24 awards, including 2 Song of the Year awards from independent musicians. In 2017, he received the Arab American Women Association Award for Education about Palestine through Performance Art. In 2015, he was nominated for the United Nations Nelson Mandela Award for Lifetime Achievement in Peace and Justice, and you are going to love his music. Tom Nielsen, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and thanks for saying people are going to love my music.
Well, they'll tell me if they don't, but I'm sure they will. Tom, you and your partner and wife, Lynn Waldron, are going to be performing this September in Toronto at the annual conference held by World Beyond War, a group that I'm the director of, and people can learn about that and sign up to join us at worldbeyondwar.org. We are very much looking forward to hearing you play there in Toronto.
Well, as am I, David, and anyone not familiar with World Beyond War should definitely be so. The work you do is really important, and I certainly am one who appreciates what you do.
Well, we appreciate you saying that. Sometimes, however, spoken word is not enough, and it takes art to reach people. Let's listen to one of your songs and then come back and talk about it. This is called Il Degore.
Let me tell you a story about a guy I know. Our stories are the same, except for a fork in the road. Well, I went wrong, and he went right. And he went looking through a rifle sight. But Jimmy had never shot a gun. There wasn't any need where he come from. But his number come up at 21, and he went to war for petroleum. Well, he liked to go out on the obstacle run and learning to shoot was a lot of fun. But over in Nam, it all came undone, 'cause he didn't want to kill anyone. There was smack and beer, the sex racketeer, under the veneer of the war profiteer. And all the Semper Fi couldn't justify, he was caught in a lie that he couldn't deny. Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle, Jimmy's caught in the middle of a Wall Street riddle. He wasn't a coward, he hadn't lost his nerve, but he was looking for a fastball and got thrown a curve. Then came the day Jimmy slipped away. I heard a CEO say he was MIA. Well, he never was found, 'cause he went underground, and he's living today on the Ile de Grey. Thank you.
that was terrific. I told you they would love it. So
I hear the applause.
You should. It's virtual, but it's there. I take it you skipped that war, Tom.
Well, I grew up on a farm. We were all farm kids. So we were all dairy farmers. And at some point, it was my sophomore year in college, I just figured I had a lot more in common with Vietnamese farmers than I did with the Wall Street brokers who wanted to pay me and go kill them. It just didn't make any sense. And, you know, there were different ways. You know, people said, well, I was a singer. And people said, well, get in the National Army Choir or do this or do that. And I just felt the easiest thing was to leave and not have anything to do with the war. And I went to South America, and that opened up the world to me. And for, you know, I left in 1970, and for the next two decades, most of those years were someplace else, mostly in South America and in Africa.
And
it was in Senegal, in West Africa, would have been the fall of 76. I was out in the Ile de Gorée, which is Gorée Island. It's off the coast of West Africa, off the coast. It's one of the precincts of the city of Dakar. So people live there, but hundreds of years ago, it was the holding station for the Africans that the Europeans, and I include United States in that designation, where they were holding the Africans they were capturing. And so the island today not only is lived on by people, but it's also a museum. They still have the cells, and they have the history of what went down there many, many years ago. And I was out there, and I ran into this young guy who was my age. I could still call myself young at that point. And he began telling me his story, and his story was similar to mine, only he thought he would be, everybody told him, like they told me also, that he would be smart enough and get a desk job. And he believed him, and next thing he knew, he was in Nam, and he just said, I can't kill anybody, and he went AWOL. And, you know, it's one of those encounters in our lives. I met him once. We had some beers on this island in the middle of the ocean, and off we went our separate ways. And I don't know if he came back. This was 1976, so it was 6 years after he had been drafted. And... But, you know, I didn't write that song till years later, and it was with talking with another person who had gone AWOL and ultimately come back to the States.
And you talk in the song about figuring out that you've been lied to. This seems to be an ongoing, recurring issue with war after war in this country, with people figuring out sooner or later that they've been lied to. I'd like to get back this disease they used to say we suffered from called the Vietnam syndrome, reluctance to believe the lies. But it seems that there are people too willing to believe the lies too quickly. I want Tom to jump to another one of your songs. Could you tell us about the song, and then we'll play it, called 18 Cows?
Well, 18 cows, and this show is too short, David. 18 cows is about an act of civil disobedience by the people of Beit Sahur in Palestine, which is part of the greater metropolitan area of Bethlehem. And in 1987, which was the end of 87, the first Intifada, this, what happened, started in early 88. It was against the law for Palestinians to have their own dairy, to make their own milk, produce their own milk. And so they bought 18 Israeli Holsteins from an Israeli farmer in Kibbutz Hillel, who was sympathetic with the Palestinian cause, Palestinian rights supporter. And they had to hide these cows because what they were doing was against the law. And so the song talks about getting, and these in the villagers weren't dairy farmers. And Amir Shomali is the co-director, and he and Paul Cohen put together a documentary called The Wanted 18, and I highly recommend it. And Amir heard about the song I wrote and contacted me from Australia, where he was doing a Palestinian film festival, asked me if he could use my song to to promote the festival? And I said, certainly.
Let's play the song.
Now he was back in 1988 with the occupation of the Palestine state. When Beit Zahur bought 18 cows, but it wasn't what the law allows. If you want to drink milk, the law of the state says you get it from Israel, not a farm you create. So 18 cows went underground, and for the next 4 years, they couldn't be found. So word come out from the high command, there's 18 cows in the promised land. They're solid and spotted, white and black, so it's time to plan a sneak attack. So 18 cows all had to hide, cause the army's coming from the other side. They came by land and choppers in the air, but they couldn't find those cows anywhere. It's against the law for milk to be made by 18 cows in the bovine brigade. 18 cows committing the crime of making milk in Palestine. Now 18 cows give you milk to drink, but that ain't all, it's more than you think. It's independence and dignity and a threat to Israel's security. Cause they might make butter and they might make cheese and other intifada utter activities, so they stay undercover and do as they please. Thinking up cow conspiracies. It's against the law for milk to be made by 18 cows in the bovine brigade. 18 cows committing the crime, making milk in Palestine. Well, hiding neath the fig and vine, 18 cows wanted dead or alive. These lactating ladies committing a crime, making milk and babies in Palestine. There was Lola and Goldie, Rivka and Ruth. I can't make this stuff up. It's really the truth. And all the others, there were 14 more in a Milky Way in the middle of a war. It's against the law for milk to be made by 18 cows in the bovine brigade. 18 cows committing the crime of making milk in Palestine. 18 cows committing the crime of making milk in Palestine.
Yeah, there's the applause. That's a great one. I like it.
Thank you.
I hear Pete Seeger in there. An influence on you?
I don't look. I mean, perhaps, but there are other people. When people ask me about influences, that I think of. I think before I think of Pete.
Yeah. Okay.
Pete actually found fault with my music geek. I used to see Pete a couple times a year, and I, like so many other people, have been on stage with him. But he said I didn't do enough sing along.
Huh.
You know, he say, and he said I was got a little too critical at times.
Yeah.
People might be surprised. But Pete liked to do songs that were...
Get everybody singing, yeah.
Yeah.
So that song about Palestine, very relevant these days. I mean, it's still an important topic in the news.
Well, certainly the occupation, the invasion of Gaza in 14, but most recently, you know, on March 30th, I think it was the end of March, when the Palestinians gathered for 45 days of peaceful protest, and they were met by Israeli military fire, tanks and gas and tear gas and bullets.
Yeah.
And I think the death rate, I don't know what it's at now, but it keeps going up, just with people who are dying from their wounds, and I believe over 1,000 people were injured from that. And, you know, this is just an ongoing genocide that the U.S. supports with its $3 billion a year, and that the U.S. Senate historically has been 100-0 in voting for. And it's, you know, I mean...
I think
go on and on and on and on about how wrong this is, and how we just need to do everything we can to stop it.
There's got to be some way to let people know that nonviolent protesters are being shot by snipers. But a song like that that we just heard, it's humorous, but it also, I think, could inform people that it's not two armies against each other. It's an entrapped population, forbidden even to produce its own food.
It's one of the strongest militaries in the world against nonviolent protesters on the other side of the fence.
Yeah.
But, you know, as one Israeli brigadier general said, and I quote, any person who gets close to the fence could be a future threat to the border of the state of Israel, and its residents should bear a price for that violation, and its punishment is death.
Yeah. They
you know, and there was a headline in the Times of Israel that says when genocide is permissible.
Right. They speak openly about genocide, and the U.S. media won't touch the topic.
Well, you know, the media, David, when this first went down, the end of March, what were the words they used? They talked clash on the border,
right.
Altercation, encounter. Everything was put in third person rather than saying this is a massacre.
Yeah. You know, I searched
as if,
for
these people met and something happened.
Right, something happened. I searched for any headline or paragraph that had the Israeli military doing anything, and in no case does it ever do anything. Things happen to it. You know?
Exactly.
Oh, it's incredible. You've got a piece that you can do live here for us.
I do. This is a new piece that I wrote just about a month ago, and I was still on tour, maybe about 2 months ago. And it's been in my head for a long time. It's part of this whole project for a new American century that the U.S. government and military have been involved with for the last couple decades. But it's about Libya. 144 tons of gold. I'm sure it was a sight to behold. Gaddafi, I'm told, was a dangerous man with his African Bank for Development plan. So Al-Qaeda and NATO fought side by side, and Hillary laughed when he died. But forgetting all the lies we've been told, tell me, who got the gold? Barack wanted Gaddafi out by September. Another humanitarian hoax. You remember Cameron wanted a piece of the pie, so his RAF jets violated the sky. And Sarkozy entered the fray because a gold-backed dinar would replace CFA. And the corporate media sold. But they never said who got the gold. Take out their national water supply. Marines standing down so Stevens would die. Thousands wounded and thousands are dead from a people's uprising, the media said. Colonial looting of what's underground. All the oil and gas that can be found. Was it Al-Qaeda, NATO, or CIA? Pilfering and looting away, I never was told who it was that got the gold. The conquest of Libya is little more than another act of imperial war. 144 tons to divide. Trilateral banks, the ones to decide. NATO's war machine plunders and kills. Now Libya's not able to pay the bills. And people as slaves are sold. But tell me, who got the gold? Yugoslavia, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, or any suitable nation, a reality is invented as a pretext for invasion. And the perfect media narrative sold. But I never heard who got the gold. So that's 144 tons of gold.
Excellent. And you don't know the answer, huh?
I still don't. I got lots of questions I never get answers to, Dave.
Yeah. It's been in the news just lately, stories about all the money that Sarkozy had gotten from Gaddafi to get himself elected in France.
I've heard a bit about that.
Yeah. Apparently, you know, playing into his motivation to be tough on Gaddafi to, you know, to avoid the scandal of being, a servant of Gaddafi. But wasn't it such a transparent lie to begin with? This pretense, contrary to the U.S. media's own reporting, that Gaddafi was massacring civilians, And then a UN resolution to aid the civilians that is immediately used to overthrow and bomb a country.
People have to understand that this didn't just happen. You know, and when was it? In 01, when the Rumsfeld memo was for the project that I talked about earlier,
right,
or referred to, for the New American Century, was to overthrow 7 countries in 5 years.
Yeah.
And this is back in 01. And Libya is one of those countries, just like Syria and Iran and Lebanon, Somalia, and Iraq and Sudan. Those were the 7. I might have repeated one twice. But so it's all about controlling all these nations with mineral wealth. And Gaddafi certainly had tons of gold. And the big fear for Sarkozy, in the midst of all this, was that the French CFA, West African currencies, are based on the French franc. And what Gaddafi was proposing was to start a new African dinar, an African currency based on gold, because the U.S. went off the gold system.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, was he was going to start an African bank to replace the World Bank, and get the IMF and the World Bank out of Africa, and get, you know, and all the debt that those two organizations impose on people, and all the currency devaluations and all this is horrid.
He also proposed peace negotiations that were not permitted or followed through on.
And that happens with regularity. I mean, there's other countries that we can bring up, too, we were not going to let any peace negotiations get in the way of a war.
Well, every single country that has been attacked, I would suggest, is on that list. And the big country not yet overthrown on that list of countries to overthrow, Iran.
But, you know, if Iran hadn't put their country in the middle of about 24 U.S. bases, they wouldn't have this problem.
Recklessness. Not to be forgiven.
Them.
Tom Nielsen, there's a song of yours that you played when I was out in Illinois that I absolutely loved, that speaks to how such disastrous policies are sold to war-cheering publics. Should we play These Colors Don't Run?
Go for it.
There's a drone in the air in Pakistan. Paramilitaries on Columbia plan. Some Sarah Weaver's hanging from a crane. Shell and Chevron in Ogoni domain. Rahm Emanuel can bully junior senators to vote for war in Afghanistan. And Gates and Clinton can rattle their sabers for making combat with Iran. Oh, you can't feel how you will. Every time you see old glory unfurled, but these colors don't run. These colors don't run. These colors don't run the world. Obama says we've lost South America, but I can still find it on a map. He keeps 50,000 mercenaries so we can occupy Iraq. You can't blockade the people of Cuba. You can't blockade information flow. You can bomb Vietnam to the Stone Age and torture in Guantanamo. And you can feel how you will every time you see old glory unfurled. But these colors don't run. These colors don't run. These colors don't run the world. You can build a wall on the border with Mexico. Build another in Palestine. Build a wall in the minds of our people while the truth you undermine. You can love your country or leave it. You can wave the red, the white, and blue. how you will every time you see old glory unfurl. But these colors don't run. These colors don't run. These colors don't run the world. Contras kill civilian populations, destroy their clinics and their schools, their crop land and water systems, till we decide which samosa rules. You can say they hate our freedoms, but look at the damage that we've done to bring every precious metal and fossil fuel and their labor under our thumb. And you can feel how you will every time you see old glory unfurl. But these colors don't run. These colors don't run. These colors don't run the world. Yeah, these colors don't run. These colors don't run. These colors don't run the world.
That was beautiful. Wonderful song. Thanks. Tell us about that song, Tom.
I wrote that shortly after Obama was elected, and after, I think probably after the invasion of, not the invasion, the overthrow of the Manuel Zelaya government in Honduras in 2009.
Yeah.
When Hillary was State Department, they put in Hernandez, who was still in there. I'm trying to think there was another muse for that, but I know that, when Obama gave that speech at West Point, and he went on and on about how the, well, not on and on, but he emphasized that the U.S. was the greatest country in history.
Yeah.
It's been this way for the last century, and it's going to be the one indispensable, that was the word he used, indispensible nation.
What does that make all the other nations, I wonder?
Dispensable, of course.
Yeah.
Like an old razor. And, you know, that just, I have to say, David, I grew up breathing the air of entitlement in this country because it was the only air here. And when I thought too that this, that there was something superior about or exception about this culture, because that's what I was learning, even though I was against the war and supporting civil rights and all this, as this national chauvinism just permeates everything here. But getting out of the country, it was in my face immediately these thoughts about my country, that that there's nothing superior at all about this, culturally or politically or any which way.
I wish we weren't out of time. Tom Nielsen, we will have the links up at talknationradio.org. Couldn't agree with you more. We're going to get out of the country together in September. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Yes, the time was too short.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says Israeli soldiers killed at least 60 Palestinians and shot as many as 2,700 in an eight-hour period on May 14th. Palestinians protesting both the horrific living conditions in Gaza and their inability, despite international law, to leave it, to return to the homes from which they were expelled, along with hundreds of thousands of people in the 1940s. At the same time, and for many U.S. viewers on a sickening split screen, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, celebrating the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, declared it a great day for peace. Media could hardly avoid revealing the disjunction, even as many worked hard to tell you you weren't seeing what you thought you were seeing, that the overwhelmingly unarmed people were a violent mob, that the snipers picking them off from a distance were defending their lives. That sort of dissonance has marked elite U.S. media coverage of Gaza for many years. Today we'll revisit conversations with just three of the people that Counterspin has heard from who are working to expand and deepen U.S. audiences' understanding of Gaza, the conflict, the context, and the possible ways forward. We'll hear from James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, from Youssef Munayer, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and from the Institute for Policy Studies, Phyllis Bennis. Gaza and the U.S. Press, this week on Counterspin. Counterspin's brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A May 15th Washington Post editorial offered a primer on elite U.S. media's view of recent events in Gaza. The piece, headlined, "Hamas Has Launched Another War, Israel Needs a Better Response," conveyed to readers that, one, Israel and Hamas are fighting a war, and Hamas is running it. It is not, then, that Gaza is a refugee camp, an open-air prison, under a 10-year blockade from Israel and Egypt, where residents cannot leave and Israel restricts what goods, including medicines, can enter, but a war in which all of the deaths just happen to be on the Palestinian side. And the footage you're seeing, it doesn't reflect Israeli military killing Palestinians, but Palestinians getting themselves killed as a means of attacking Israel. Two, all Palestinians in Gaza are Hamas. They are not people with their own response to conditions in Gaza, where the water is largely undrinkable and electricity only works a few hours a day, unemployment is at 44%, and as the LA Times' Ann Simmons reported back in February, quote, "breakfast for some school children is a cup of hot water flavored with a dash of salt," close quote. All protesting Palestinians are Hamas, cynical and bloodthirsty and the cause of any conflict. Thus, when unarmed people are killed by sniper fire, the Washington Post has prepared you with a label for those people. Quote, "nominal civilians," close quote. Three, it's okay for Israel to kill protesters. The Post suggests the appropriate response to Monday's massacre is relief, since if Israel, quote, had allowed thousands of Palestinians to pour across toward nearby Israeli communities, the bloodshed could have been much greater, close quote. In other words, Israel would have killed more of them. And let's call it 3.5. Those who object to Israel's lethal and illegal actions are mindless robots. That's the unhidden subtext of a line like, quote, "on cue, condemnations of the government of Benjamin Netanyahu poured in," close quote. If and when you have absorbed these concepts, then, when Israeli Deputy Minister Michael Oren tells the CBC that the sole purpose of the protests was to, quote, "break the fence and kill Israelis and destroy our country," close quote, that might make sense to you. After all, it's what the Washington Post suggested, too. Though you might be left to consider whether the Post editorial board likewise shares Oren's view that journalists who ask questions about Israel's actions are responsible for the bloodshed. Counterspin has talked about U.S. media coverage of Gaza many times over the years. It's not true that nothing's changed, but it's remarkable how much has not. In July of 2006, we talked with James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute and co-founder with James Abaresque of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. His 1975 book, Palestinians, the Invisible Victims, has just been republished with Mondo Weiss. A month before we spoke with Zogby, Israel Defense Forces soldier Gilad Shalit had been captured by Hamas militants. He was later released in a prisoner exchange. This is James Zogby from 2006.
I think that generally the problems in the U.S. are a function of how we have, in our broader culture, come to perceive the conflict as one being Israeli humanity confronting a problem. And the problem is always seen in an objectified, not very personal way. We know the name of the soldier. We even had in a couple of articles the names of the soldiers who were killed at the checkpoint when Shalit was kidnapped. But we don't know the names of any of the Palestinians who were victims and have never seen stories really about them. And so there's a sense of a very personal conflict that Israel is facing versus an impersonalized political problem that Arabs have to get over so that Israel can live in peace. And everything else flows from that. There's an asymmetry not only in power. Israel's got power, Palestinians don't, but an asymmetry in compassion. Israel suffers and Palestinians don't.
Well, and it's true the media coverage seems to be all about timeline and who started it, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the timeline virtually always seems to start with a Palestinian action to which Israel responds, you know. And also the timeline doesn't go back very far. In your recent column on Gaza, widely circulated on the web, you talk about some of the relevant history of Gaza that many people may never have known. Can you tell us a little about that history?
Well, Gaza is one of the most depressed areas on Earth. It is one of the most highly congested areas in the world. And with 80% of the population living today at the poverty level, 80% of young people never had a job and no prospect of a job. When the single largest source of wealth in Gaza was day labor jobs in Israel, and they've now been replaced by civil service jobs because that was the only way that the PA could absorb those young unemployed men, and they are now not being paid, you have an economic basket case. Compounding that is the fact that because Israel has maintained off again and on again closure of Gaza since the early 90s, but has since the election of Hamas intensified that closure, even after they so-called withdrew from Gaza, they withdrew from the interior of Gaza, but maintain their fortifications and their strangling of Gaza land, sea, and air. The result is that you have what amounts to a prison camp. People are free to roam around the yard. They can get occasional gifts from outsiders and visits from international visitors, but they cannot go out freely, do business, and live a regular life. This is not only an economically distressed area, it's not only suffering from shortages of food, fuel, and medicines, but there also are tremendous psychological problems that are developing as people are hemmed in to a very small area and have been hemmed in literally for their entire lives without gainful employment. It's a nightmare. And you're right, absent the history, what started it all is that, you know, the prisoners did something bad.
Mm-hmm.
Why they're in prison, how this all developed, that Israel has shown no intention of loosening their grip on Gaza, none of that is reported. And frankly, history could have been very different, but never got a chance.
Well, it's interesting your point on last year's kind of withdrawal, because the flavor you might get from U.S. coverage was that Israel redeployed from Gaza last year, and that was kind of a gift that the Palestinians have squandered.
Israel's ability to control the narrative, to start the story where they want to start it, has been, I think, very significant in all of this. The reason why it's Israeli humanity versus the Arab problem is from the very beginning. I mean, the earliest years, Israel portrayed this as one leading spokesperson called it decades ago, the forces of civilization confronting barbarism. It stuck. When it was tiny, Israel declared its independence in 1948 and was attacked by its surrounding neighbors. It stuck. all the way up to Barack made the best deal ever, and Arafat rejected it and turned to violence, and it stuck. As we learn in the play Murat Saad by Peter Weiss, when the people hear it over and over again, they believe it. Palestinians not accustomed to telling their story, but believing that justice is on their side and people ought to get it, have been victims, I think, of the fact that they've not engaged in the West to tell their story and to project their storyline so that history doesn't begin whenever the Israelis say it begins, with the Israeli victims responding to the Palestinian attack. I mean, that's how the Israelis want to tell the story, but frankly, Palestinians could tell another one, and they just never get a chance to do it.
Well, let me ask you finally and briefly, it's always interesting and disconcerting to us how much more critical of Israel the Israeli press seems capable of being than the U.S. press. And I'm thinking of a recent piece in Haaretz by Gideon Levy in which he said, there is no violence worse than the violence of the occupier. So the question about who fired first is therefore an evasion meant to distort the picture. I think many Americans would be shocked that that perspective is aired openly in Israel.
Back in the 1970s, I used to distribute translations from the Hebrew press to a network of people when I was running the Palestine Human Rights Campaign. And I learned as early as back then that you get far more debate in Israel than you do here, and far more debate in Israel than you certainly get in the Jewish community here, far more debate in the Knesset than you get in the U.S. Congress. And the result of that is that the forces in Israel who want peace don't get support from their counterparts in the United States, because we end up supporting the hardest line, the most reactionary positions, and those courageous journalists and peace activists in Israel never get any support from us, because frankly, their counterparts in the U.S. and the liberal wing of the Democratic Party are so blinded either by fear, willed ignorance, just not wanting to know about it, or because they actually believe the crap they read in the American press, they don't do anything.
That was author James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, talking with Counterspin in 2006. In November 2012, Israel was pounding Gaza with drone missiles and artillery. At the time, Counterspin spoke with Youssef Munayer, then director of the Jerusalem Fund, now executive director of the coalition, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. This is Youssef Munayer talking with Counterspin's Steve Rendell in November of 2012.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to talk about where does it all end when we don't really understand where it all began. And the problem with, the United States media, and I think it's not just the United States media, but particularly in the United States, is that this is not an important issue in the United States media priorities until it is at crisis point like it is now, when people start paying attention. But when you only pay attention at crisis point, you lose all the nuance and the context and the history that led up to this that are vital for understanding what the problems are and consequently how to solve them. And so I think that to have a discussion about how to move forward and how to fix these issues, you know, we need to have a much better understanding of the genesis of these issues, of the underlying causes and factors for Palestinian discontent, for us to understand how to resolve it. And unfortunately, I think it's just the nature of our media that is, you know, far more concerned with spending endless TV hours on the salacious affairs of military generals than talking about the serious problems that affect people around the world. I think the coverage is extremely slanted towards, the Israeli perspective. I think that's slightly improved over time, but still largely in favor of the Israeli narrative. And I think the proof of that is that, you know, when Israeli citizens are not being, you know, bombarded with rocket fire from Gaza, there is no coverage of deaths that are continuing to take place because of Israeli incursions and violations in the Gaza Strip. It is only when Israelis are put under a difficult situation that the U.S. media starts to pay attention. And so because of that, we really lose perspective here as viewers and as readers and as a general audience of U.S. media. And of course, as to your point, this is not a war. You know, this is by many been covered as a war between Israel and Hamas. This is not a war. This is not two armies or two states, you know, battling against each other. This is a domestic problem where the Israelis are repressing violently the dissent of Palestinians who are demanding their rights from a state that does not want to give it to them. And we need to put it in that context to really understand what's going on. Unfortunately, you know, in the world of two-minute sound bites and whatnot, it's not conducive to proper understanding of an extremely nuanced situation whose genesis is 64 years in the past.
Well, I mentioned at the top the regional political changes, and there's been some funny discussion in U.S. media about those changes. NBC News correspondent Andrea Mitchell, in what could be described as an awkward moment of candor, stated, quote, "So you don't have a reliable dictator or a totalitarian leader in Egypt whom the United States can do military-to-military and diplomatic relations with," close quote. She was lamenting the fact that there's no longer an Egyptian dictator to help the U.S. and Israel manage the Palestinian problem. What does that tell you about the American media?
Well, I think she, along with policymakers in Washington, are also lamenting the loss of dictators throughout the region to help them manage the Palestinian problem. You know, what that means is that the media reflects U.S. interests and U.S. policy, which has always been to favor stability through the use of force and the imposition of dictators throughout the region without concern for the popular will. And it is particularly clear in the Palestinian case, where you see the legitimate grievances of the Palestinian people being denied so long as there are friendly allies of the United States willing to cooperate in denying them. And I think until we're able to talk about those legitimate grievances as, in fact, security issues, then, you know, we're not going to realize the impact that that has. We cannot keep just saying we're going to keep them, you know, under wraps. It's just not going to work. I think the Arab Spring has proven that that's just not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this has shown us in Gaza is that as much as you might want, as much as the Israelis might want the Palestinians to go away, they're not going to go away. And you have to start dealing with them as human beings, as equals, for there to be a just solution to this issue, because the use of force is simply not going to work.
In your New Yorker piece, you seem to think that the time for a two-state solution is passing or has passed. In the remaining time, I wonder if you could talk about what possible good solutions might be available.
Well, look, there are flaws to every solution. I don't think a one-state outcome or a two-state outcome are perfect, and I don't think we're going to have a perfect solution. But the bottom line is a solution that's going to work is the one that comes closest, that's the closest approximation to justice for the largest number of stakeholders involved. And unfortunately, the two-state solution is no longer able to provide that if it ever was. The continued expansion of Israeli colonies on Palestinian territory have made the process for peace a process of turning Palestine into little dismembered pieces. And the possibility of a Palestinian state emerging there, I believe, is beyond the realm of geographic and physical possibility. So we need to start thinking about what other outcomes within a one-state framework can provide for an approximation of justice for the largest number of stakeholders possible. The first step is having that discussion. Then we can start talking about policies that will move us in that direction. But it's about time to have that discussion.
That was Youssef Mounayer, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, in 2012. And let's give the last word for now to Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. We spoke with her last month at the beginning of the Great Return March. I asked her about NPR's characterization of events, quote, "Tens of thousands of people in Gaza answered the militant group Hamas's call to protest," close quote.
extraordinary. That was picked up all over the place, that Hamas somehow was the originator of this thing. It wasn't. This was Palestinian civil society in Gaza, which is very vibrant despite the horrific conditions where there's 97% of the small amount of water available is undrinkable. Electricity is only available between 2 and 4 hours a day. The sewage system has never been rebuilt after the 2014 assault by the Israeli military, with the result that the beaches have been fouled. It's a horrific catastrophe of humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And yet, there are these very vibrant social movements and organizations, women's organizations, trade unions, youth organizations, sports clubs. All of these were involved in calling for this protest. The protest organizers asked for endorsement and support from all the political parties and got it. They all signed on, Fatah, Hamas, all of them. And because Hamas controls the, to whatever degree it exists, which isn't much, but the degree to which a governing structures exist in Gaza, it's controlled by Hamas. They're the ruling party. They won the elections in 2006. And in that context, they provided bus availability to get people to the area where the protests were happening, that sort of thing. But the idea that this was somehow called by Hamas is simply not true. Hamas rarely calls for this kind of mass protest, largely because they don't control it. And there's a lot of discontent in Gaza with Hamas, as with Fatah, in the context of the much greater anger at Israel for the years of occupation and siege and this long-standing blockade that's been underway that prevents Palestinians from having a functioning economy, from having clean water, from being able to travel, from being able to escape from what many around the world have called an open-air prison. I think what is important right now and what's not getting enough attention is the fact that Israeli human rights organizations, one in particular, B'Tselem, the very respected, long-standing human rights group inside Israel, started a campaign yesterday that is absolutely unprecedented. In a set of ads around the country, they are calling on Israeli soldiers to deliberately resist orders to shoot to kill. They've used the term patently illegal to describe these orders to shoot anyone approaching the fence. And the reason that that phrase is so important, it has a particular history in Israeli military law. In 1956, there was another massacre of Palestinians in a village called Kfar Qasim, a very well-known massacre site. And on that occasion, the village had been put under a sudden curfew by the military with virtually no announcement. And the Border Patrol agents were told by their commanders, shoot to kill anyone who comes outside his home or her home. And the Border Police went along with that. And they fired and they killed 47 Palestinians. These were Israeli Palestinians. This was inside Israel in 1956. And at that time, there was a legal challenge. And the judges found that the order to shoot was what they called patently illegal. And they went on to define what that meant in saying that what the soldiers were essentially trying to use was the Nuremberg defense. I was just following orders. And the judges said that's not okay, and that an order that is patently illegal must be disobeyed. And they described what that means as saying, and this is, I'm quoting the judges here, Israeli judges, we're not dealing with a formal, hidden or not, illegality, not one seen only by scholars of law, but a clear and obvious illegality, a certain and essential illegality of the order itself, an illegality which pierces the eye and enrages the heart, assuming the eye is not blind and the heart is not made of stone or corrupt. It was an extraordinary, almost poetic description of how outrageous and how obviously illegal this order was, kill anybody outside their home in their own village, you know. The same way, the idea that you can shoot anybody who approaches the border fence on their own side of the border when no one is at risk, there is no danger to life, there is no mortal threat, which is the only basis on which live fire can be used. It's patently illegal. And using that term is a very important one. Now, the sad reality is that neither B'Tselem nor the other brave Israeli human rights organizations have very much influence these days as the political discourse inside Israel has moved so far to the right, unfortunately, particularly among young people. Mm. But it is important for the international community that Israeli human rights defenders themselves are actually calling on their own soldiers to defy these illegal orders. That puts the human rights activists themselves at B'Tselem at great risk. And their willingness to take that risk of isolation at the very least, if not potential legal consequences, it speaks to how serious this set of violations is and speaks to the obligation of the international community to answer it.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, talking with Counterspin last month. In an interview with Vox, Youssef Mounayer cited a New York Times op-ed written by a Palestinian in Gaza explaining why he goes to protest, even though he has a family he loves and he values his own life. "I go," wrote Fadi Abu Shamala, quote, "because I hope that there is a chance that change can come and that my children don't have to live the difficult life that we live, and that is worth risking my life for," close quote. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website. It's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to subscribe to FAIR's newsletter, Extra, or to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
We made a mistake that will crash the 2-degree warming guardrail not by 2100, but before 2030. That is coming right up. Our second interview is with the co-founder of the Transition Town movement, Rob Hopkins, with his personal transition. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's get going. Imagine you are a scientist exploring the secrets of the atom. Then society takes that discovery to make bombs that blow up cities. Now imagine you study the way water breaks up rock underground. It's an obscure specialty, until industry leaders decide to use that data to explode the underground for methane, also known as natural gas. Money is made, but that technological choice blows up the future. They call it fracking. Since 1977, Dr. Anthony R. Engrafia has been a popular professor teaching structural mechanics and fracture mechanics at Cornell University in New York State. He and his students published over 200 scientific papers. Engrafia has been a lead investigator in projects for major corporations like Boeing and Grumman and for government agencies like NASA and the National Science Foundation. He's won a ton of awards for his work. When it comes to fracking rock, this is an expert's expert. From Ithaca, New York, Anthony Engrafia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the honor of being with you today, Alex.
Is it all right if I call you Tony?
Please do.
Okay. Now, in 2011, you and another professor at Cornell, Robert Howarth, published two major papers on the climate impacts of fracking. And in November 2011, I interviewed Dr. Howarth and broadcast the Radio EcoShock show titled Fracking Gas Equals Climate Crash. Now it's 7 years later. We knew what was coming. Has the gamble of frack gas turned out as you thought it would?
Unfortunately, it did. And I don't mean that in a positive sense. I mean that in a negative sense. What my colleague Bob Howarth and I predicted in our 2011 papers has unfortunately been borne out by subsequent science done by many people in government and academia, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
Well, let's go back a bit. Tony, what were you studying about underground rock before frack gas became a mainstay of energy production in North America?
I had begun studying fracture of rock in my doctoral studies in the mid-1970s, initially to try to understand how to mine rock for heat, also known as geothermal energy production. But very soon after I joined academia in 1977, we had a president at that time who was gung-ho on renewable energy, and he was followed by a president who was anti-gung-ho on renewable energy. So research and development in mining heat turned into research and development in mining more gas and more oil. So before the shale revolution began early in this century, I was working with the oil and gas industry to enhance their capabilities for hydraulically fracturing rock that was not shale in order to produce more oil and gas from increasingly stingy deposits around the world. So it wasn't until early this century that the industry unlocked finally the formula, the technological formula for getting oil and gas out of shale. So I had done some preliminary research in that area way back in the early 80s, courtesy of the United States Department of Energy and the U.S. taxpayer. But that was a different time then. We weren't very conscious at that point in the early 1980s about climate change or the environmental impacts, the negative environmental impacts that development of oil and gas from shale would really wreak.
You were in the right time and place. Maybe you could have become very, very wealthy with your fracking expertise. Why didn't you join the big race to frack everywhere?
I'm pausing to answer that question, Alex, because my wife asks me the same thing frequently. And I actually get accused by people who don't like the message I bring that I have enriched myself. I haven't. I don't take any remuneration for any of the public education I've done over the last decade or so in trying to inform the public and regulators and legislators and governors and even the president about the negative aspects of shale gas. Certainly, I've been invited by a number of oil and gas entities to rejoin the industry to help them improve the process of stimulating shale gas and stimulating oil out of shale. But I've chosen not to because I made a conscious decision 10 years ago that that was a very bad thing to do from a technological point of view, from a climate change point of view, and personally from a moral and ethical point of view.
Speaking of fracking everywhere, if a corporation wants to locate an industry with truckloads of toxic chemicals and lots of air pollution and noise, they are regulated usually into an industrial park or something. How is it possible in America to find fracking pads right next to schools or hospitals or even among homes in American suburbs?
I'm pausing again, Alex. I wish I knew because I have spent a tremendous amount of time over the last 10 years involved in lawsuits brought by families who are suffering the consequences of exactly what you just described. They were quite comfortable living in a urban residential area or a rural residential area, typically in a zoned community, and they woke up one morning to find themselves in the middle of an industrial operation, a heavy industrial operation that is the only one, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, that is permitted to go beyond the normal bounds of zoning. That's that issue. What can zoning do? What can a local community do to enforce its own zoning regulations is at the heart of literally dozens of lawsuits that are occurring every day around the country in many states. And to directly answer your question, it's beyond me how we got there. The oil and gas industry is the only one, to my best knowledge, that has that exceptional power to overrule local zoning powers to keep an industrial, a heavy industrial activity restricted to an industrial zone. It's literally allowed to go every place that you just described. It can be in my backyard, your backyard, within a few hundred feet of a school or a daycare center, within a few hundred feet of a hospital, within a few hundred feet of a food store. That's the way that things have developed in this country, largely because of the excuse of we need the energy and we have to get the energy. And today they use phrases like energy independence, or more currently, energy dominance or energy security. And the point is that fossil fuel source is one source of energy, but it's not the only source of energy, and it's not the only one that we could be tapping right now to meet all of our energy needs while at the same time making us energy secure and energy independent. So hidden in all the words I just gave you is the word politics, the word lobbying, the word influence. But I'm not qualified to talk about those things. I'm just an engineer, and I'm befuddled, absolutely confused about why it is that we can allow this heavy industrial energy to invade, literally invade our communities.
And your video presentation, though, does suggest five narrowly defined goals that sound like good reasons to introduce this technology. Can we talk about those and what they are?
Sure. These are the what I called in my video for the Bedrock series, the narrowly defined goals of the development of shale for oil and gas. The five narrowly defined goals are jobs, economic growth, energy security, energy independence, lower energy prices, and the displacement of dirty coal from our energy picture. Those are all very good objectives, very good goals. And to a large extent, in many locales around this country, we have succeeded to some degree in all five of those. But the point I'm making in my video is that complete success in all five of those areas is still a narrow victory, because it would only benefit about 5% of the world's population. And every one of those has an impact on 100% of the world's population. So it's easy for me to understand how an industry can convince regulators, legislators, from the local level all the way up to the federal level, that these narrowly defined goals are good things. It's obvious that they're good things. But the larger question is, for whom are they good? Well, they're certainly good for gas and oil companies and their shareholders. They're certainly good for some local businesses until the bust comes. They were certainly bad for coal. They were temporary in some cases, because obviously lower prices for some fossil fuels are going to go away as our fossil fuel resources deplete again, as they inevitably will. They are not renewable. And the concept of energy security, energy independence, as I just pointed out a few minutes ago, is ephemeral. The best way for the United States and every single country on the face of the earth to be both energy secure and energy independent is to produce all the energy it needs within its own borders. And the easy way to do that is with renewable energy. It's the easy way for the United States to become energy secure and energy independent.
You then go to the broader unintended consequences, and these are super important. They're huge. First, could you make your case that fracking caused the elongation of the fossil fuel era?
Yes. So the amount of oil and natural gas being produced in the United States was on the decline. Both oil and gas were on the decline, both from onshore and offshore sources, up until the discovery that it was possible to get oil and gas out of a heretofore unobtainable source, shale. The real revolution that we should be talking about is not fracking. Fracking isn't new. The real revolution was the application of a very specific form of fracking to a form of rock that had never been fracked before, and that's shale. So what was happening at the turn of the last century, in 1990s to 2000, is that we were rapidly depleting our own supplies of natural gas and oil. And other countries around the world were also depleting their supplies. And had we been wise at that point, and by then we recognized that climate change was upon us because of the use of fossil fuels, and had we been wise to see that we had wonderfully modern and cleaner means of supplying energy to all the countries on the face of the earth, renewables, we would have just ridden that decline all the way to its end. And my insight is that by this time, 2018, had we not turned to shale, we would be much farther along in the renewable energy transition that has now been delayed by 20 years. So the brief answer to your question is we were running out of everything. The United States had gotten to the point where it was only producing about a third of the oil that it needed, and we were importing natural gas, literally importing it because we could not meet demand. And what shale has allowed us to do is almost double the amount of oil we're producing and to increase by over 30% the amount of natural gas we're producing. And that's a definition of elongation, whereas we should have been in decline naturally because we were running out of stuff. We suddenly opened this door. We opened the cellar door, what I call the dark, dank basement of the fossil fuel resource on the face of the earth, the last remaining dark, dank corner, shale gas, shale oil. We figured out a way to get it out. We took that technological gamble, and here we sit 20 years farther into a fossil fuel era that should have been dead by now.
And you graphed out a timeline of the growth of shale gas fracking and the early exponential growth of wind power. Talk to us about that relationship and how much potential wind power was lost because of shale gas.
It's remarkably coincidental that I can show three graphs that all have what I refer to as kinks in them. And all those kinks occur in roughly the same period, 2005 to 2010. So let me remind your listeners that in 2005, 2010 is when shale gas and shale oil really took off. So the three curves that have these remarkably coincident kinks are, number one, natural gas production in the United States. In that same era, 2005, 2010, we were in decline. We were actually importing natural gas. And suddenly there's a kink and we have a drastic increase in natural gas from shale. Is that a coincidence? Well, what's cause and what's effect here? The other coincidence is if we look at a graph of methane concentration in the atmosphere, we see that over the period roughly 1990 to 2002, 2003, the concentration of methane in the atmosphere was flat. It wasn't increasing, it wasn't decreasing, it was remaining the same. Suddenly and coincidentally, in that same period, 2005, 2010, we're seeing a drastic increase in methane concentration in the atmosphere, which is very important because methane is the second most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide. And the third coincidental kink in a curve is if I make a graph of the amount of wind energy that's available in the United States, starting at the beginning of this century and up until about 2007, 2008, we were on what a mathematician would call an exponential growth curve. The amount of wind energy being produced in the U.S. was roughly doubling every year. And then in that same period, 2005, 2010, that exponential growth died out. It kinked. It became linear. In other words, it keeps increasing, but at a much slower rate. So we have these three coincidental kinks and three closely coupled curves. They're all interrelated. They all result from that technological gamble that the operators and legislators and governors and presidents decided to take roughly 15 years ago, and here we are. We have these coincidences, and none of them are good. The worst of them is that methane concentration in the atmosphere continues to rise, and that's exacerbating climate change.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest, Professor Emeritus Anthony R. Engrafia, was a pioneer in rock fracturing science at Cornell University. He says fracking gas is a gamble with the world's climate that we can't afford, no matter how cheap the gas appears to be. So, Tony, the final and worst unintended consequence, which you've touched on here and in your YouTube video, is about the worsening of climate change. due to a new dependence on burning shale gas. And your first graph is from a paper led by Drew Schindel of NASA, published in the journal Science in 2011. Tony, what did their data show about the warming of the Earth since 1900? And then tell us about their projections.
What their paper showed, what the graph they're referring to that was in their paper showed that in the period 1900 to 2009, global warming had occurred to a degree of about 7/10 of 1 degree centigrade. So relative to the average temperature between 1890 and 1910, that was their zero, global warming had occurred at about 7/10 of a degree centigrade by 2009. And that was generally accepted by scientists around the world. They also, in their paper, decided to use computer simulation, the very, very best computer simulation that was available in 2010, 2011, to try to forecast, based on the history of global warming to that date, how global warming would occur over the next century. And, of course, they tried a number of different scenarios depending upon what the world was going to do with fossil fuel and greenhouse gases. And they realized that their computer simulations were, of course, just fortune-telling. They weren't truth. They were the very best scientific effort to try to predict what would happen. And so they were subject to error. And in their paper, they showed four different scenarios of what might happen between 2010 and 2070. And they also showed the error bars on their predictions. How far off do you think they could be high? How far off do you think they could be low on each of these four scenarios? And what they showed in their original paper is that regardless of which scenario you picked, we were going to get to 1.5 degrees centigrade by about 2050 or before, or in some cases way before, by 2020. And people were saying, well, geez, we have plenty of time. You know, the worst is 2 degrees centigrade. But their paper also showed that we would get to 2 degrees centigrade by as early as 2040. Or perhaps not until later this century, depending upon which scenario. So I show that graph in my video, and then I show a new version of that graph because the graph is old. It was published in 2011. And the data, the actual measurement of global warming, had been made 8 more times since that paper was first published. So what I did was to take the NASA-measured global temperatures for each of the 8 years after 2009, and I put those points on a new version of the graph. So in other words, I was adding data to the data that was in the original graph, which is what had happened between 1900 and 2009, went up 7/10 degrees centigrade. And to my disconsternation, when I plotted these additional 8 points, I found that we were already at 1.5 degrees centigrade in 2017. So the dreams and hopes of the Paris Accord that we would do our very best worldwide to try to avoid 1.5 degrees centigrade is a pipe dream. We're basically already there. And when I plot those new 8 points on this revised graph, I see that all of the simulations, all the predictions by simulation made by Schindel and his colleagues were wrong. They expected them to be wrong, but they were wrong in the worst possible way. Every one of them underpredicted the rate of global warming. The worst case scenario that they predicted in 2011 was that we would not get to 1.5 degrees centigrade until about 2040, but we're already there.
And you suggest that we might reach 2 degrees centigrade, which is sort of the let's go to catastrophe mark, as early as 2030. Are you confident in that?
I'm not confident. I'm scared to death, but I'm looking at the data and trying to visualize an extrapolation through these new 8 points, which of course don't all fall on the line. They do what all the temperature measurements made in history do. They go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. But in general, they're showing an increase. And if I just plot a straight line through those 8 points, we're at 2 degrees centigrade before 2040.
Okay, so in 2011, you and Robert Howarth of Cornell published 2 papers, and the most cited is published in Climatic Change. And it reports that frack gas, if I may summarize, results in far more greenhouse gases than either the government or industry were reporting. And I believe you said frack gas was more polluting than coal. Is that correct?
From a climate change point of view, absolutely correct. It's because when you burn natural gas, you get carbon dioxide, just like you do when you burn coal. You get less carbon dioxide than you get by burning coal for the same amount of energy produced. But methane, natural gas, is also a greenhouse gas. And any methane, natural gas, that gets into the atmosphere unburned turns out to be about 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a global warming agent over a period of about 10 to 20 years. And I just got through telling you and your audience that we only have 10 to 20 years to worry about this problem and fix it. Let me rephrase. Over the next 10 to 20 years, every kilogram of methane that gets into the atmosphere unburned is 100 times more powerful, more potent as a greenhouse gas warming agent than carbon dioxide, meaning any small amount of methane is equivalent to a very large amount of carbon dioxide. And what we said in our 2011 paper was that we thought then, and we still think now, that a significant percentage of natural gas that's mined in the U.S. and in Canada and in Argentina from shale gets into the atmosphere unburned because of purposeful venting or accidental leakage. And we said that significant percentage is somewhere around 4, 5, 6, 7, 8%. And it doesn't matter whether it's 8% or 6% or 5%. If it's more than about 2 or 3%, it's deadly from a climate change point of view. It's worse than all the other fossil fuels.
But in the other article published in 2011 in the journal Nature, you and Robert Howarth argued that fracking should stop. But Terry Engelder from Penn State University said, and I quote, "The good news is that methane has a very short half-life in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide emitted during the building of the first Sumerian cities is still affecting our climate, whereas escaped methane from the fracturing of the Barnett Shale in 1997 is more than half gone." So isn't that a good news story? That's sort of the industry point of view.
Well, Terry Engelder is a good friend of mine, and we vehemently disagree. What he said is correct. But I said right before you said what he said is also correct. Methane only resides in the atmosphere for about 10 or 12 years, and then it becomes mostly carbon dioxide. But during those 10 or 12 years, it is a very potent warming agent. And I just got through telling you and your listeners that we only have 10 or 15 years to fix the problem. So during the 10 or 15 years that we have to fix the problem, all the methane that's being exhausted into the atmosphere today is warming.
Well, we won't have time in this interview to talk about fracked oil and its effect on the climate, and that just adds on to the whole problem.
Yes, it does.
It does. Okay. Now, in your video, you asked about, well, what do you think is happening in other countries? And I note that the French President Emmanuel Macron just visited the U.S. He dined with President Trump and then told a joint session of Congress that, yes, we should worry about climate change. If, according to the map in your published paper, France has a world-class reserve of natural gas waiting in its rock formations, what is happening with fracking there?
Absolutely nothing. It's forbidden.
Wow.
So France has taken the path of there shall be no shale gas development. But I already mentioned two countries that have followed the United States lead, in fact, the suggested lead of the United States way back in the Obama administration. Here is U.S. technology that we want to export. We're going to show you how to get oil and gas out of shale. And Canada is the second largest producer of oil and gas out of shale. And the third largest producer is now Argentina. And there are at least a handful of countries around the world that are exploring, experimenting with using this relatively newfound American technology, directional drilling, high-volume fracking, special chemical formulations, clustered multi-well pads. All that adds up into getting oil and gas out of shale. And so we've now exported. We've made the problem worse because not only are we doing it, and adding our extra carbon dioxide and our extra methane into the atmosphere, we're encouraging other countries to do the same thing.
Would those countries include the UK or Australia?
The UK, there is now fracking permitted in England. It's not permitted in Scotland. It's not permitted in Ireland. Australia, some of the provinces of Australia have said no, they're in moratorium. Others have just decided that they're going to begin exploration.
And you end your recent YouTube presentation by asking what each of us can do to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. Some folks in North Carolina are taking it to the streets. They're trying to fight off more fracking by their energy giant, Duke Energy. Isn't local resistance a big part of trying to stop the shale gas menace?
Yes, it is. And any kind of nonviolent resistance, activism, advocacy, is exactly what we need. We need to depress the supply side of fossil fuels and also depress the demand side. That's what each individual can do. That's what I tried to emphasize in my video. So if you are taking an advocacy position or a peaceful activist position to try to get corporations and legislators and governors to slow down or even prohibit the development of shale gas and shale oil, you're depressing the supply side, and that's good. If you decide on the demand side that you're going to stop using a fossil fuel, for example, to drive your car or to heat your home or to heat your hot water or to cook the hot dogs in your kitchen or to light the light bulbs in your house, that's also a good thing to do. Both of those send messages to the market. We are a capitalist society. The transition that we're in right now from fossil fuel-based energy resources to non-fossil fuel-based energy resources is one that will be won in the marketplace. So who rules the marketplace? Consumers. So stop consuming or decrease your consumption of fossil fuels. Do what you can to inhibit the supply using peaceful means, even if it's a letter to the editor or carrying a banner in a protest march or putting a sign in your front lawn or voting for people who think the way you do about this energy transition. That's all good stuff. And at the same time, vote with your pocketbook and make sure that your next car is an electric car. Make sure that you really investigate whether you can heat your home and cool your home with an electric-driven heat pump where the electricity is coming from a renewable source. See what you can do about putting solar panels on your property or buying into a community solar farm. See what you can do to help the development of wind farms in your area rather than inhibiting them. These are all the kinds of things that individuals can and must do as participants in what has to be an energy transition, because if we don't have the energy transition, we're going to have the worst of climate change, and we don't have much time to do this. We've only got about a decade of years in which we can make significant change.
We have been talking with Dr. Anthony R. Engrafia, the emeritus holder of the Dwight C. Baum Professorship in Engineering at Cornell University. Ironically, this strong opponent of the modern fracking industry is one of the most published authors on how rocks fracture. And you can find links to his must-watch YouTube video that we've been talking about and all the papers we've discussed and more about shale gas fracking in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tony Engrafia, thank you for helping us understand the gamble we've taken.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you think the future looks troubled, a personal bunker is not the answer. We will need each other and resilient communities. Dr. Rob Hopkins is a world leader in that quest. He is a co-founder of the Transition Town Movement, the Transition Network, and author of essential books like The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. We're going to talk about Rob's new venture and his shorthand guide to going forward. Rob Hopkins, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
I've been wanting to talk to you for some time, and I noticed looking at your blog on March 13th, 2017, you announced that while still helping the transition movement, you would take some time off to explore a new topic. How has that worked out for you and for the Transition Town movement?
Well, it's sort of still work in progress, and I still do a lot with transition. I still do a lot of traveling and speaking and stuff. But I've been doing some research around imagination, and I read a piece of research a few years ago that was a researcher in the U.S. who gathered together something called the Torrance Test for Creative Thinking over the last sort of 60, 70 years in the U.S. And her conclusion was that IQ and imagination rose together until 1990, and then they parted company, and IQ kept rising and imagination started to decline. And when she published it, it was on the front page of Newsweek. It was a really big story. What does this mean for economic growth and for Silicon Valley and for Hollywood? I never heard anybody in the climate change, social justice movements who even mentioned it. And it struck me as a really interesting thing, you know, that what we're trying to do in transition and in many other similar movements is to help people imagine a different future, you know, reimagine what's in front of us in a different way. And maybe if actually there's a problem with our collective imagination, that's something we need to give some thought to and work out some strategies for how to manage that.
And are you planning that to be a book? Is that the thought?
Yeah, that's the plan at the moment. It's going quite slowly, but that is the plan, yeah.
All right. Well, here's what I propose. I'd like to start with a dialogue with a bit of chat on imagination and then work back to community resilience and how to get there. Does that sound all right?
Perfect. That sounds great, yeah.
Great. So I looked at Wikipedia, which isn't always that authoritative, but it has this definition for the word imagination. It says that imagination, the ability to form images, ideas, and sensations in the mind without any immediate input of the senses, such as seeing or hearing. And if you could let me explain for a minute, I think there's a possible dangerous side to that. And that's because, as you know, Rob, in the Dark Ages, people valued imagination more than their senses, and we got witches and other imaginary beings. And then Francis Bacon comes along and conceives of science in order to bring humans back to their senses to deal with things as they are, measurable, hard, and real, and it's sort of a guide against the perils of imagination. How do you see that relationship between imagination that we should cultivate and science?
Yeah, I mean, the definition that I like is a woman called Maxine Green, who said that imagination is the ability to look at things as if they could be otherwise. And actually, that's really been the foundation of most great science. You know, Albert Einstein went out on his bicycle and cycled about and daydreamed and imagined himself as an atom flying through the universe. I don't see that there's any, that it's, you know, either we have imagination or we have science. You know, most of the best science really has its roots in the imagination and then in a way that's kind of tested rigorously and so on. But, you know, I think for me, the problem at the moment is that we seem to have put all of our eggs into the scientific basket, I suppose. And we have less and less opportunities in our lives, I think, in 2018. To allow our imaginations to really flourish. You know, our education system has become much more about learning stuff, passing exams, being tested from the age of four, much less room for the arts and for play and for being imaginative. Our workspace is often much more, you know, ticking boxes and so on and so on. And then universities, there seems to be less space for it. The time when we would wander around and daydream and allow ideas to come to us, we seem to be filling up with hours and hours spent on smartphones and on Facebook and so on. You know, so for me, it's not that we need imagination exclusively, because if we just cultivated purely the imagination, we'd all just wander around and not achieve very much. But if we are trying to figure out a way forward in the times we are in now, with the challenges that we face, then having a really strong, healthy imagination, the ability to ask what if, which lies at the heart of science, I think is also something that needs to really lie at the heart of our activism.
And what about technology? Is that anti-imaginary?
Certainly not by definition. You know, there's lots of technology that can really help and facilitate that. But I think we seem to increasingly be seeing forms of technology which are about capturing our attention attention and holding our attention and giving us very little in return. And these sort of dopamine-driven apps and tools that are, I think, very harmful to the imagination. One of the guys I spoke to, a neuroscientist, he said, I think that our imagination, the degree to which our imaginative is, runs opposite to the amount of time that we spend on our smartphones. There is a kind of a bit of a perfect storm of things that are coming together that are really not helping the imagination in terms of we spend a lot less time out of doors, we spend a lot more time in front of screens, you know, 60% of our time awake, we sleep less because of these devices. And I think when we start to look at all these things together, I think our imaginations are really quite challenged, because in order to have a healthy imagination, we need to have spaces where we come together with other people to be imaginative, and we know people spend less and less time engaging with each other. We need to be rested. We need to have we need to have a space where we can do that, and we have less and less time in our lives to just look out the window, dream, talk with other people. How could it be? And I think that's a real danger.
You know, what you've just said with the neuroscience, I wonder, is there a particular part of the brain where imagination takes place, and could it wither away as we watch our prepared media, movies and games and television?
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the things that's been most interesting to me, is there's a small part in the brain called the hippocampus, which people always associated mainly with memory, as it being the center of the memory. And although, you know, there's, I suppose when I was a kid, you know, you'd sometimes see those sort of china heads, you know, with the different parts of the brain being put down to different things. That idea that each aspect of us is belongs to a different part of the brain is something that they're really moving away from now, neuroscientists, and saying actually it's about networks and different networks that fire at different times when we're doing different things. And there are particular networks that are connected to the imagination, but the hippocampus is really central to all of those. So it's the place where our memory exists, but it's also where we imagine the future. And the thing with the hippocampus is that it is uniquely vulnerable to cortisol. So when people are traumatized, when people are stressed, when people are very frightened, neuroscientists can see on scans that the hippocampus visibly shrinks. When children are brought up in environments that are traumatic and unstimulating and stressful, they have visibly smaller hippocampi than people who don't have that. So I think that there's something about when we live in a world which is constantly pumping out dystopian visions of the future, fearful messages, when we are in a high state of anxiety, we can't even put our phone down without feeling anxious that we might miss something, then I think we're at a time when, you know, our hippocampi are very vulnerable and very fragile. So for me, there's that question about, well, how do we create those spaces where we can come together and actually revalue the imagination, I suppose, create the optimal conditions for our hippocampus to flourish.
I can picture the activist campaign, Protect the Endangered Hippocampi.
Not the endangered hippopotamus.
Not quite.
Hippocampus, yeah.
Now, look, if we assume that indigenous people continue to cultivate imagination, have you or will you consult with those cultures in your exploration?
I have been talked to some interesting movements in India who are doing very interesting work around alternative approaches to education. And I'm soon talking to a guy in Hawaii who's one of the indigenous people in Hawaii about the way that they use visioning and imagination to tell a story and to really bring the future of that island to life. And I recently interviewed a woman who does a lot of work with indigenous people in South America and looking at what they bring to that. So, yes, that is a part of the exploration.
Now, Britain's Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher adopted a slogan from Herbert Spencer that said, "There is no alternative to the market-based system of capitalism." Rob Hopkins, what is your response?
There's always an alternative. It was one of the many ludicrous things that Margaret Thatcher said over the years. And the idea that there's no alternative is a perfect way to shut down the imagination in any setting. If you say, no, that's it, there's no alternative. You know, of course there's an alternative. And part of the problem, I think, is that a lot of us swallowed that. And that actually what we see now as being this kind kind of terror of these sort of dystopian visions of the future, the degree to which we struggle to imagine a future which is fair, sustainable, a society that is able to live within its limits. Part of that is because we have been sold this idea that there is no alternative to neoliberal capitalism in the way that we currently see it. And I think part of our work, part of what we try and do in transition is to say, of course there is. In fact, actually, you know, if somebody says to me, well, if there is an alternative, what would it be like? Describe it to me. You know, I always sort of piece something together out of things that already exist. You know, I can say, well, I would wake up in the morning in a beautiful apartment block built out of straw bales with local straw, local timber, 100% composting toilets. I'd walk out through the gardens, through streets with not very many cars in and, you know, really thriving local businesses. And I'd drop my kids off at a school which had changed how it taught, and there was much less testing, and the school was a real example of all of these kind of things. And, you know, I can paint that picture for ages, but when I'm doing that, it's not some flight of fancy of my imagination. It's really piecing together things I've already seen. I've stayed in an apartment block like that in Geneva. There are schools like that in Finland. You know, all of this stuff already exists in different places. So actually, when somebody says there's no alternative, it really speaks to their chronic lack of the imagination. The danger when someone like Thatcher says it is that it kind of becomes infectious and people buy into it.
Your journey got me wondering, is there a public imagination, or is imagination always a private and individual experience?
I think there's both. I think that we do have a kind of a shared imagination, and stories that we tell each other and stories that we believe and that we buy into collectively. Yeah, and I guess that was what that research I mentioned at the beginning was looking at, was there was a big enough data set that she was saying, well, actually, this looks like it's reflective of the collective imagination. Clearly, we all have our own individual imaginations, and there are things that we can do to make ourselves as imaginative as possible. But at the same time, I think, you know, that when the imagination really sparks into life for me, and it's something that I've seen again and again with transition projects in many different places, is when people come together. And the thing that I've been writing about recently is about this idea of what if, you know, making these what if spaces where people can come together with other people and say, what if we had our own money here, or we had our own bank, or what if we did this in a different way and then went off and did it? You know, we've been doing transition now for 11 or 12 years, and we now think of it as being a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world, and you have to do both of those things together. I was in Liège in Belgium a couple of weeks ago, where they had I went there 4 years ago, where their transition group had just started, and I went to an event that was all framed around a what-if question. And the question was, what if, in a generation's time, the majority of food eaten in this city came from this city, or the land around this city, the land immediately around this city? And they invited together farmers and scientists and chefs and shop owners and everybody with an interest in food, and just opened a space with that as a what-if question. And then I went back after 4 years, and they've started 14 cooperatives. They've raised 5 million euros from local people. The municipality, the local government, are completely behind it and making a load of their land available to the whole thing. I met the mayor of the city, who said, 8 years ago we wanted to be a smart city, now we want to be a transition city. You know, and when I talked to them and said, well, how did you get here? How did you... You know, in 4 years, how did you make all this stuff happen? And he said, well, because we had a really strong what if question, and we held that space. We didn't say we've got it all worked out. They just held a space that invited people's imagination in, and then when they did that, all kinds of things were then able to happen.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Rob Hopkins. He's the author of many books on creating communities resilient to problems of the present and the expected shocks as a troubled future unfolds, or perhaps as a better future unfolds. Is that a fair assessment, Rob?
Yeah. I'm very interested in the future, and I refuse to kind of buy into that idea that the future is inevitably going to be rubbish. And I think there's every possibility that we could still create a future that's really quite amazing, but it needs us to come together and get on with it, really.
The first transition town was famously in Totnes, England. We broadcast in several countries, though, and more than half of Radio EcoShock listeners are in the United States. Can I ask how far the transition town movement has penetrated into America?
Yes. So it says there's 163. I just looked up. There's 163 transition initiatives in the U.S., and you can find them on transitionus.org. Transition US, which exists as what we call a national hub, so it's like the national organization which sort of supports and trains and tries to connect together the different transition groups across the US. So it's something like that, yeah, about 170. I know they had a national conference earlier this year, and there seems to be a lot of activity happening in lots of places.
I do get feedback from listeners who are involved in it or want to be. But I do worry that my own program and even the science presented by Radio EcoShock can become trapped in a bubble of English speakers in Western-style culture. So I'm curious how transition is received in other parts of the world. I mean, is the movement still valid, say, in heavily populated areas of China or Indonesia?
Yeah. So when we started transition, we were really inspired by something that was called contraction and convergence, which was a climate model at the time, which said at the moment the global north consumes about 80% more than it should. It needs to bring its carbon footprint down by about 70-80% to a level where the global south can then meet them, and then that's the kind of point at which things can continue, you know? So our kind of founding inquiry really was, what does it look like if we see that move as a move forward? Because if in the global north we see that as a move away from something, as a move towards less, as kind of going backwards somehow, then it's not going to happen. If we don't have the stories about how remarkable, how extraordinary, how fascinating that world could be, with its amazing flavors and tastes and events and all the stuff that could happen there, then we're just simply not going to do it. So for us, it felt really important that we were basically designing a sort of a detox program for the affluent West, if you like. We weren't designing a model that was going to work in China or Africa or somewhere like that. What's been really fascinating has been to see transition being picked up by people in the global south and taking it and making it their own and changing it and adapting it. There's a lot of transition happening in Brazil, in Colombia, in favelas, in Sao Paulo, in Brazil. A lot happening in sort of Southeast Asia, Korea, South Korea, starting in China, bits of China, little parts of Africa. And in South America, it often kind of sits alongside the kind of Buen Vivir, Via Campesina kind of movements. And people pick it up as a tool and adapt it and make it their own. And that's really fascinating to see for me, because that really wasn't the original intent of the model, I suppose.
But that is really exciting. And you've written a new guide. It's called 7 Steps to Creating a Sustainability Transition Movement in Your Community. Where will that appear? How can my listeners find that?
Well, actually, those come from something that we did that's called the Essential Guide to Doing Transition, which is a free guide that you can find at transitionnetwork.org. It's there as a resource for people to download. It's a kind of a full-color guide to getting transition started where you are. And there's two there. There's that one, and then there's also another one that we did for COP21 when that took place in Paris, December 2015, that was called 21 Stories of Transition, where we went out to the transition movement and said, we're off to Paris, we're going to go and fly the transition flag at the COP21 negotiations, which stories should we take? And we were sent in hundreds of stories by transition groups from around the world, and we condensed those down into 21 and produced this really good little book that tells all of those stories. So if people want a crash course in what transition is, and then some tools for how to get started, have a look at transitionnetwork.org and you'll find them all there.
On the subject of climate change, I've just finished a series of interviews with top scientists, and they have dire news about much earlier than expected signs of severe climate change, things like the ocean currents slowing down and a long list. How seriously do you see the climate challenge, Rob?
It's the thing that keeps me awake at night, really. I mean, it's, I suppose, one of the main reasons why I've given the last 12 years of my life and before to all of this has really been because of the science those guys are talking about. I have children and maybe grandchildren aren't too far away in my life, and that's really what motivates me, absolutely. I think the bit that where I tend to focus my energy is on that, you know, if we were to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that take and what would it look like? And Kevin Anderson, who's one of the most brilliant sort of interpreters of climate science, I think, had a conference recently that was called the Radical Emissions Conference that was about what would that be like, actually? If we were able to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that mean for transport, for food, for energy, for employment, you know? And there's people, all of that stuff, you know, we could do that. We could still do that. You know, it's not that we will avoid climate change, because climate change has already started, but we could certainly avoid it spiraling completely out of control. But in order to do that, we have to be able to imagine what it would be like to wake up in that world and how extraordinary it could be and what possibilities it would offer, and then tell that story. And so that people are thinking, well, why would we want to go there when we could go there? That could just be fantastic. So it's that bit about imagination and story that really fascinates me. I've really noticed over the last few years how my role of going out and talking about transition has increasingly become kind of being a storyteller. You know, I gather stories from one place, I take them to another place, and it's really a movement of stories that we always say to people. You can start a transition initiative wherever you are. It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to pay an annual membership. All the resources are there for you for free. The only condition is that you share your stories. And so whether it's people starting a food garden in a street in Brussels, or the guys in Sarasota doing food gleaning projects, or, you know, big local currency community energy projects, those are the stories that people need to hear, because they don't hear that stuff anywhere else. And if the imagination needs anything, it needs a kind of a big palette of ideas and possibilities and stories to draw from. That's really what feeds it and where it all comes from, you know.
Do you think we can retool this civilization, sort of remake it from the inside while it's still standing? Or do we need a collapse before something new can really happen?
Well, my sense about collapse is, you know, and I've been around a lot of people for a long time who've been motivated by collapse, is, you know, from what I was talking about before about the hippocampus and the idea that the imagination shrinks and contracts in a fearful, when it's fearful, when it's in anxiety, is that if we're going to have a collapse, then the thing that will make us most effective during that time will be the health of our imagination, our ability to imagine our way through that and be creative and flexible and adaptable. And if we're going to avoid a collapse, it'll be because we're at our most imaginative. And so for me, whichever way we look at it, being as imaginative as possible is really important. And actually, if we try to motivate people to get involved by warning of an imminent collapse, I think we don't engage very many people. It doesn't really work. It's not a very skillful way to really inspire people to get involved in something. And I've seen it with a lot of people I know who, you know, there are a handful of people who you can talk to about collapse and who are able to somehow transmute that into being very driven and motivated and getting on with stuff. But most people don't respond in that way. What works much better, in my experience, is painting a picture of what we could create from this point going forward.
It's interesting you say that, because I've talked to psychologists, including from Britain, who have said the same thing, that humans are not motivated by fear towards real change. There's another book out called The Transition Starts Here, Now, and Together. I haven't seen it. What can you tell us about that?
So this is a book which a guy called Lionel Astouc, a French writer, came to Totnes, where I live, and interviewed me every day for a week, and then went away and wrote this book. So it's kind of my words, but kind of arranged by him. And it's a particular kind of a format. that is very popular in France, these sort of interview-based books. So it'll be really interesting to see if anybody reads it in the US, or, you know, how it goes. I think it has a really nice flow to it. It's kind of me talking about me, I suppose, a bit, and where the transition idea came from, and, you know, how it grew, how it evolved, what it looked like in Totnes. So it's quite sort of autobiographical, quite conversational. And in France, people have really, really enjoyed it. It came out of a film that was called Tomorrow, or in France was called Demain, which came out in late 2015, which was a film about, you know, the world we could create now, the tomorrow that we could create, which I appear in, and which was incredible phenomena in France. It won Best Documentary in the French Oscars. It was millions and millions of people saw it. It ran in mainstream cinemas for months and months. So this is a series of books that they've done with some of the key people in the film going into it in more depth and kind of telling their story.
I have been hoping to talk with you for a long time, and now here we are, and I still feel like I'm missing something important. Would you like to just take over this microphone as we wrap up and tell our listeners anything else that's on your mind these days?
I guess it feels to me like, you know, what we've done in transition for the last 12 years has been an experiment, really, and it's an experiment that many of your listeners will have been part of and contributed to and seen happening around where they live. And I love being part of something that has that permission to play and that permission to experiment. It feels very rewarding now to look and see some of the stuff that's happening in transition groups where they're starting to make a real difference and build new businesses, build new infrastructure. And that's the stuff that gets me out of bed, you know. It's like the story I mentioned about Liège or all the other places that you go to where people are saying, this is the thing that we want to do. This is our future. This is our story for the world that we want our grandchildren to see. And we've started it, and it's going really well. And I feel like I know more people than I ever knew before. And I feel part of something historic that's moving, something that's changing. You know, I'm with other people. We're working together. We trust each other. There's something so magical about that. I just love it. Every time I see it or experience it, I kind of see the future, the hope for the future that we're all trying to create.
We've been hearing from the social activist famous among millions of people wanting resilient ways of living. Rob Hopkins is the author of two key books, The Transition Handbook from Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. He is now offering a 7-step guide toward community building, and soon we hope a book that will literally stimulate our imagination. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Rob Hopkins, thank you so much for being with us on Radio EcoShock, and I hope we can talk again.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Check into our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening this week and caring about our world.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Sick the lives like manatees, calling it a chance to please, more like a catastrophe. Birthright towards a court and I'm confused, I'm into moving in. Claim it's only names and words, but denying the root of them. Power been abusing it, I passed never excusing them. 60 years since 48 and 40 since Jerusalem. My boy Shaddy wanted to visit us so badly. He lied, he's diabetic.
magnetic, but see it for 5 seconds. 194 rule the courts in the case. Mom, you can't disconnect the people from the importance of place. My email misses people, not places. Have you seen the towns with names in Arabic, the Hebrew places?
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm here in Oak. We're here with Sunaina Mehra. She is a professor at UC Davis and also the author of Boycott, the Academy and Justice for Palestine. You mentioned the War of Position, and that's a theory by the great late Italian communist writer Antonio Gramsci, the War of Position versus the War of Maneuver. Can you talk a little bit about that more and how you bring that in to talk about the context of BDS as a tactic and a tool?
Right. So in fact, one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, the war of position is the struggle to challenge dominant cultural beliefs in contrast to the war of maneuver, or open war and armed attack. And it's been key to understanding the successes of the boycott as a social movement that has challenged the hegemony of Israel. So as we've been, you know, discussing, that has been based on a set of popular beliefs that normalize the policies of Israel. And so I think the ways in which I see the BDS movement reflecting on it, you know, over the last 10 years, now, is that I think what it has been instrumental in is doing is through these kind of small incremental steps, really challenging the normalization of this kind of Israeli exceptionalism in the U.S. And so I think in that regard, it's very important because, you know, Israel itself is very concerned with this war of position. So it's very apparent. I mean, they themselves talk about the fact that, you know, they're deeply worried about what they call delegitimization of Israel. And so there's a war of legitimacy. And I think it's very important to note in this regard, by the way, that this is not about the existence of the Israeli state, okay? I mean, because there's all this kind of really melodramatic, you know, kind of allegations that BDS is out to destroy the state of Israel. But I think if we think about the three principles of BDS, it's fair to say that they point out the fundamental flaws in the notion of Israel as a self-professed democratic state that, you know, affords equality to its citizens. And so in that regard, I think, you know, BDS has provided a discourse that now people can pick up and use to challenge that exceptionalization of Israel as being above critique. And so going back to the point about multiculturalism, I think one of the things that Israel has also tried to do through its Brand Israel campaign is to kind of present the image of being multicultural and cool and gay friendly and, I don't know, women friendly and worker friendly and African friendly and all of these things, which are not true. And so I think, again, the BDS movement, I think, has provided, you know, kind of ordinary people with a language that they can use to basically, you know, rupture this kind of myth.
As you said, and as you write, the role of BDS is providing that language. And it's a textbook example of a social justice movement like any other, but has received a minuscule fraction of the recognition and research. And here's where the scholarship on BDS and the Palestinian liberation struggle overlaps with the fight against neoliberalism in the U.S. academy, increasing privatization and the censorship of academic research or basic activism on campus, as you said. Can you talk about the role of BDS, a little bit more about how we can talk about BDS as a central player, you know, in terms of elevating the Palestinian liberation struggle as just another social justice movement?
Right. I mean, for many people, that's an oxymoron, like thinking about Palestinian liberation as being a social justice issue. And, you know, in your book, Nora, on the student movement and, you know, BDS activism, I think you noted, in fact, that, you know, BDS activism has become the kind of social justice, one of the fastest growing social justice movements on college campuses. And that really struck me because I think, you know, that really indicates the kind of 180 degree shift that has happened, you know, in many campuses where, you know, we see that people have completely reframed, you know, the issue of Palestinian rights or Palestinian liberation. And so I think in that regard, you know, to me, what is really kind of important is that on the one hand, you see masses of students taking up the cause, you know, of Palestine and getting engaged in BDS and bringing it into social justice activism. So there have been so many alliances that have been made between, you know, Palestinian, you know, rights campaigns and Students for Justice in Palestine organizing and campaigns against the militarization of campuses, policing, police brutality, Black Lives Matter, also thinking about, you know, issues around, you know, walls and immigration and refugees, as well as, you know, these questions around, you know, kind of apartheid and racial equality. and academic freedom. And I think all of those have helped to transform BDS into a social justice issue. But, you know, fundamentally, it has to be acknowledged that, you know, BDS is a framework that was provided by Palestinians. And I think that, you know, there are two points to be noted. One is that, you know, it wasn't always like this, that I think in the United States in the 60s and the 70s, there was a moment when, in fact, radical activists were in solidarity with the Palestinian liberation struggle, and that leftists and anti-war activists actually were critical openly of Israel. And so I think in a way the BDS movement has allowed campus activism to return to that internationalist framework of third world solidarity, which has been, you know, diminished somewhat in the last decades, or even when it emerged, you know, for example, challenging the war in Iraq. I mean, there was just never a connection made to Palestine. And then the second point, you know, I would say is that I do think that Israel's own excesses have fueled some of this, you know, outrage and sympathy with Palestinians. And because of social media, I mean, the work you do, for example, in Electronic Intifada and other outlets, it's harder for people not to know what's going on. And so I think that for, you know, both of those reasons and other factors, probably, I think it has become more of a social justice issue. So, you know, when I first started getting involved in the Palestine movement, you know, about like, you know, 17 or 18 years ago, I mean, you know, people used to call it PEP, you know, mm-hmm. Progressive Except on Palestine. And I felt like Palestine activists were so marginalized, and it was so frustrating, and we felt so isolated and constantly under siege in the community, you know, not just on campuses. And, you know, I think that shift, so that I think we're getting to the point where I think we're almost there where to be progressive, you do have to stand with Palestine, I think is pretty remarkable.
Let's talk about the role of the academic associations, which you mentioned before, in taking the boycott movement forward. In your book, you write very personally about how you and other professors started going on self-funded fact-finding delegations to Palestine to see for themselves what was going on, and came back ready to take collective action, which ultimately resulted in an overwhelming approval of an academic boycott resolution, as you mentioned, by the American Studies Association in 2013. This was after the Asian American Studies Association passed one earlier, but with less of a spotlight. You note in your book that the passage of the ASA resolution made the front page of the New York Times, and quoting Edward Said, who said that Palestine was the last taboo in the U.S. public sphere, you say that the taboo had finally been broken. Talk about the interviews that you did with professors in your book who went on these kinds of delegations, and really what the overall collective response was gearing up for the ASA convention in 2013.
Yeah, that's very important. You know, I mean, I think that the delegation that was organized by the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, a U.S. ACBI, was really a key event in catalyzing that resolution. The scholars who went to Palestine, this was actually in January 2012, were all scholars in American studies. And actually, you know, even more significantly, they were all scholars doing critical race studies, feminist studies, queer studies, labor studies, and black studies. And so I think these were scholars who actually, you know, were sort of deeply invested in, you know, work related to social movements, and had an international framework that they brought to them. And I think that it's significant also that it was a self-funded trip, because they were not getting any financial support. It was not a holiday in Palestine, if you can take one. But, you know, I think they were very committed to actually going and seeing for themselves the conditions on the ground. And so when they returned, they were so deeply moved. I think people are always transformed, you know, when they visit Palestine. It's always shocking, no matter how much you've read or seen, to actually witness what's happening with your own eyes. And so they decided that they wanted to propose a resolution to the ASA because it has taken positions on matters of public concern. And I think this is also important to note, that this was not the first resolution, as the Zionists have argued, that the ASA ever bothered to endorse. They've actually taken positions on the war in Iraq and labor issues. And so we began a process, scholars in U.S. ACBI, of actually having open discussions and town hall meetings and circulating a public petition to educate people and to, you know, sort of get support for the boycott resolution. And it slowly began, you know, to get clear to us that, in fact, many people were really sympathetic and ready to support BDS. And so when the resolution was finally put to the association, you know, in November 2013, there was a town hall meeting that was organized by the association, not by US ACBI, to give all members an opportunity to speak openly about their views. And the overwhelming majority stood up and said publicly that they supported the academic boycott. And these included not just, you know, tenured scholars and senior academics, but graduate students, adjunct lecturers. You know, they took this risk because they were so firmly committed to this. And, you know, I say this, Nora, because, you know, in the Zionist lawsuit against the ASA in response to the boycott, there are all these ludicrous allegations that this was a somehow secret, you know, conspiracy to take over the association for the purposes of boycott. And to the contrary, it was one of the most public grassroots campaigns that had ever taken place in the ASA, you know, in recent history. And so it was actually incredibly energizing. It brought together people. And I think after this town hall, you know, where you had Angela Davis and Stephen Salida and other speakers talking about Palestine, there was an online ballot in which, again, you know, the overwhelming majority voted to support the boycott. And this came after the American Studies, Asian American Studies Association resolution, which was also, you know, one supported by critical ethnic studies scholars. I think we can also see the ways in which, you know, the academy, its critical ethnic and race studies and feminist and queer studies scholars who are in the lead in trying to bring these issues into academic spaces.
Talk a little bit more about the lawsuit. Last year, an Israel lobby group and a group of Zionist academics filed a lawsuit against scholars who support Palestinian rights on top of the 2016 lawsuit against the American Studies Association itself, in an effort to punish and discredit academics who challenged the dominant narrative on Israel in the U.S. Academy. Palestine Legal said at the time that it was, quote, a harassment campaign at the highest levels, and that professors targeted by the lawsuit were subjected to death threats, rape threats, and other misogynistic and racist hate mail. You were named in this lawsuit as a member of U.S. ACBI. Can you talk about this as a jumping off point to discuss the backlash and intimidation movement, what you call the archive of repression?
Yeah. So, you know, speaking about the lawsuit, you know, I think it's really, you know, it's a legally baseless lawsuit. Most of the claims have already been thrown out by the court in this legal complaint against the ASA. And, you know, I think the bottom line is that, you know, the Zionists lost, you know, in this very public democratic vote. And so the response has been to use these immense resources, as you said, in lawfare, you know, to harass and intimidate and defame scholars who, you know, dare to organize in BDS campaigns. But I think there's something even deeper than that. And I think it's about this shift that we were talking about earlier that's happening. I think because they realize that they're losing, you know, this war of position in the academy, and it's becoming now actually, you know, more of a progressive issue to support Palestine. I think partly the lawsuit was actually designed to silence other academic associations, to try to send a message that if they dare to follow the example of the ASA, that this is what they would be subjected to, because it actually came a couple of years after the vote in the ASA. So logically, I mean, you know, the fact that they waited so long to file this lawsuit suggests there was something else at stake. And it was actually filed in the middle of the American Anthropological Association conference. And so we know that, you know, this was when the AAA was also voting on a boycott resolution. And, you know, there has been a domino effect. I mean, there have been a string of associations that have, you know, passed boycott resolutions after the ASA. It was sort of like, you know, the dam had been opened finally. And so people felt it was permissible and it was desirable. And so I think it was designed to do that. And it's not working. You know, I mean, the truth is, in fact, I mean, there are conversations happening in so many fields by now. But I do think that, you know, the other part of this, Nora, is, as I talk about in the book, this archive of repression reveals that also what's at stake is a certain kind of racial and gender and sexual politics and class politics. And, you know, the Zionist backlash network is really, you know, heavily focused on targeting various progressive movements. I think we have to look at the confluence of anti-Zionist politics and, as you said, social justice politics. And so as increasingly we have, you know, for example, academics of color and ethnic studies scholars like myself taking the lead in BDS organizing. This is deeply threatening to the Zionist establishment in the U.S. and also Israel, because it means that, you know, support of Israel is no longer a cool multicultural issue, because in fact, you know, masses of, you know, students of color and faculty of color are now standing in solidarity with Palestinians. And that is actually something that's very troubling. But I think it's very important, because one of the things that has always concerned me as an activist of color and an ethnic studies scholar is that I think the racial politics of Zionism have actually often been very muddied in the U.S. It's been very difficult to be clear about it. And what the academic boycott in particular has allowed us to do is to see anti-Zionist politics as anti-racist politics. That, to me, is a really fundamental shift, because it means it pulls out the rug from all these Zionist critics who allege that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic and racist. So it becomes the opposite. It means that if you critique, you know, settler colonization in Israel, you're actually anti-racist, and BDS is an anti-racist movement. And that, to me, is like, you know, an incredibly important kind of intellectual or kind of, you know, sort of epistemological victory for BDS.
Can you talk a little bit about the amount of self-censorship that you see in the academia world, and if you think that that is moving, you know, budging in any direction?
Yeah, you know, I think self-censorship was always a very important tool. You know, like I was saying earlier, you know, it was partly the pressures that academics have always been under that led them to staying away from this issue themselves without anybody knocking on their door and telling them to do so, without getting a memo from their dean that they had to do so, right? It was this kind of tacit, unspoken kind of, you know, assumption. And I think that's why it was like, you know, hegemonic, you know, as we would say. It was just this kind of normative discourse that was so powerful. I think that's changing. I mean, I think that what we saw at the ASA town hall meeting about the boycott resolution is people were volunteering to speak publicly about their support, you know, for Palestine, despite the risk that they might have incurred. Now, I think that, you know, the self-censorship has not entirely gone away. Obviously, I think people are still very cautious. And I think that the Zionist Backlash Network has also ratcheted up its tactics. So we see that there is more public blacklisting, right? And the blacklists have kind of, you know, proliferated. And we have various shadowy groups like Canary Mission that publish these online and threaten, you know, prospective employers, you know, on behalf of student activists. We have posters being put up on campuses with people's pictures. And so I think that that level of smearing and McCarthyism is designed to create self-censorship. So, you know, it's not that every administrator needs to write a letter to their faculty telling them, you know, not to support SJP, but I think that there is this culture of fear that has been created around this issue. And I think the only way through that is actually through public activism. Like, I think the only way to break that wall is, you know, to come out with a hammer and smash it. Because, I mean, the more you stand in the shadows, the more people want to, you know, be like, you know, kind of lurking in the dark. And so I think that's why the BDS movement was also so significant, because it meant that people could come out in the open. And we have senior scholars, leading, you know, intellectuals who are saying, I support Palestine. So it gives people courage that it's okay to do so.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about the founding story of USACBI. Its origins, and really how it's evolving now, 9 years almost after its inception.
Yeah, you know, the founding story of USACBI is also very much about coming out of the shadows as academics, because in fact, it was during the war in Gaza in 2008 and 2009, when, you know, you had this horrific massacre. I mean, I'm saying again, because, you know, we are currently going through a period in which, again, Israel is assaulting, you know, people on the border of Gaza on a weekly basis at the moment. But during that war in the winter of 2009, there was actually a group of us who were part of an academic freedom network in California that was concerned with censorship in Middle East studies, who felt that, you know, we needed to be able to respond. And, you know, Nora, the thing is, you know, when people say we don't know what to do, I mean, Palestinians had said in 2004 and 2005, this is what we need you to do. So in 2009, it had already been 5 years since that call for academic and cultural boycott had been issued. So we decided to respond and to actually form a national campaign that would actually mobilize people in support of the academic and cultural boycott. Because, you know, the call had been issued earlier and people had responded in a scattered way, but there wasn't actually a structure for getting people to endorse the boycott. So at the minimum, we wanted people, you know, to have a place where they could publicly endorse the academic and cultural boycott and then hopefully also do organizing. But, you know, USACB has never had any, you know, grant funding or staff. We don't have an office, and it's a collective made up entirely of volunteers. So we're all, you know, people who are working in the academy or elsewhere, scholars and activists and artists. And by now, we have people all over the country in every region, and we've also, you know, always had the support of this incredible advisory board of like leading, you know, international activists and human rights leaders. But I think, you know, it's been hard work. And there was actually a point at which a Zionist think tank, the Reuters Institute, I think, said that if we had 500 endorsers, we would be a strategic threat to the state of Israel.
That's
so
all
I guess,
it takes.
Yes, I know. That's all it takes. And it took us a while to get there, but we did become a strategic threat to the state of Israel. And I think that what is actually really kind of important about USACB is that it's a very diverse group. So in fact, you know, many of us are not, you know, Palestinian or Arab. We work in different fields. You know, we've been involved in other kinds of social justice activism. And the lawsuit that has recently been filed now explicitly targets USACB because I think there's a realization that somehow this motley group of professors managed to actually do something that, you know, the Israeli state, I think, never thought that an academic association in the United States would actually endorse the boycott of Israel. They kind of assumed that this was a bastion of, you know, pro-Israel thought. And so I think it's been really significant. Having said that, it is a struggle, you know, to do what we do. And I will say we recently launched a campaign to boycott study abroad in Israel programs on March 30th on Land Day, which was also the day that the Great March of Return was launched in Gaza on the border. And I think this is a very significant campaign because it allows, you know, students and faculty and staff in their own campuses to pledge not to participate in study abroad in Israel programs. Because these programs are fundamentally whitewashing programs that provide, you know, kind of academic cover for Israel. They're very biased. They're usually based at Israeli universities that are extremely, you know, problematic and complicit with the state and the occupation. And so I think this is, again, something that, you know, individual students and faculty can just go online to the USACB website and endorse the pledge not to participate in any way as a student, as a teacher, as staff support in study abroad in Israel.
What was it like for you going back over the history of USACB and your own personal activism and the activism of others in your field? And writing this book, it's short, it's 150 pages, but somehow you managed to pack a lot of information and history and context in there. What was it like writing this book?
You know, it was a really meaningful process for me. And for me, of all the books that I've done, this one meant the most in a sense because it was an opportunity to think about my own personal and political involvement as well as the involvement of other people. And because it was the first book about the academic boycott movement and one of the first, you know, academic monographs about BDS, I guess, it was a bit challenging when I was thinking about how to write it. But, you know, Nora, I'm an ethnographer by training. And so my, you know, inclination is generally to try to tell the story through, you know, other people's stories, you know, to try to actually kind of glean from people how they make meaning of events or issues. And so I decided that I wanted to interview, you know, my comrades in USACB and other scholar activists to sort of get their perspective, because I think each one brings, you know, something really important to this issue, like putting together, you know, the pieces of the puzzle in a sense, because people have different vantage points. And so I decided that I would do interviews with other, you know, academic boycott activists, but also look to some of the documents about the academic boycott campaigns, as well as, you know, by now there's a lot of documentation online as well, you know, so reports by Palestine Legal or IJAN, as I mentioned, or reporting in Electronic Intifada or other outlets. And for me, the process was challenging also because the series editors put a very short limit on the books, as you said. It was 150 pages because, you know, they wanted it to be a book that students would actually read. So it is, by the way, part of a series called American Studies Now, and it includes short books that can be read by undergraduates on, like, you know, sort of flashpoints, you know, in our times. And the fact that they included, you know, BDS and academic boycott to me is really significant. So I was so lucky to have, you know, the support of my editor. I feel like the series editors, Lisa Dugan and Curtis Maris, who were both part of the ASA's leadership, by the way, they were extremely supportive. And so it was so refreshing to be able to write openly about this issue and to just make it a good, well-researched book. And so I decided, you know, that I didn't want to give, you know, too much context for Palestine and Israel, but to really think about, you know, as you said, the boycott is a social justice movement. And since I do research on social movements, you know, to me, that was really exciting to think about what's the paradigm of the movement, what are the strategies and tactics, you know, what are the campaign approaches and locations, and then to think about it in relation to other boycott campaigns in the U.S. and also in Palestine.
And if people want to learn more about your book or U.S. ACBI, where can they go?
Sure. So, you know, the book is available through the University of California Press, and it's also a digital book, by the way. So I think there are links to getting the e-version. And for those who want to learn more about academic and cultural boycott campaign, they can go to www.usacbi.org. And I really urge people who are listening to this to do that. And if they haven't endorsed USACBI, they should try and do so.
Sinan Omera, the book again is Boycott, the Academy and Justice for Palestine, out now. Thank you so much for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast. It's always wonderful to see you and speak with you.
Thank you, Nora. This was amazing.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of protest and the subsequent massacre of Palestinian civilians by Israeli soldiers. James S. Henry of Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, who examines the purpose and use of the multi-million dollar slush fund controlled by President Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen. And activists speaking at a rally against the incarceration of women and girls at Connecticut's York Prison, who are challenging the nation's money bail system that discriminates against the poor. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A decade ago, during a peak in Colombia's 50-year civil war, the army lured young men into the city of Ocaña, 400 miles from the capital city of Bogota. According to the Guardian newspaper, once there, the young men were killed by soldiers and declared rebel fighters in order to boost the headcount of the number of leftist insurgents killed. The murdered civilians, often referred to as false positives, were in fact executed to boost U.S. military aid to Colombia. Many army officers involved in the killings were promoted to higher ranks. According to the Guardian newspaper, a new report co-authored by a retired Colombian police officer claims that 10,000 civilians were victims of false positive killings between 2002 and 2010, more than triple the number of murders earlier estimated by human rights groups. Even as Colombia's largest rebel army, the Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, laid down their arms in a peace deal in 2017, false positive killings are still occurring. Colombia President Juan Manuel Santos, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the peace deal with FARC, was Minister of Defense from 2006 to 2009 at the height of the false positives killings. Human rights activists complain that neither Santos, former President Alvaro Uribe, or any Colombian general has yet been convicted for their role in these war crimes. Kentucky, a red state that embraced Obamacare, is changing course under Republican Governor Matt Bevin. The Bluegrass state is set to be the first in the U.S. to enforce work and community engagement requirements for some Medicaid recipients. Critics condemn the move, embraced by the Trump administration, for taking away health insurance from tens of thousands of low-income people. They note that the majority of Medicaid expansion enrollees in Kentucky are already employed, mostly in low-wage jobs. They argue that requiring people to work won't mean there will be employers that will hire them. To remain eligible, able-bodied working-age adults without dependents in Kentucky will have to work at least 20 hours a week, be a full-time student, or complete a number of other community engagement activities ranging from job searches and vocational training to community and caregiving service. Not meeting one of those criteria would lock people out of coverage for 6 months. Health advocacy groups have sued the state, asserting that the program violates the Social Security Act. During a rally of affordable housing activists on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, a white counter-protester, Sonia Trauss, a leader in the Bay Area Yimbyism movement, Yes in My Backyard, moved through the crowd and got involved in a confrontation with veteran activists from the city's communities of color. Trauss, whose efforts are funded by Silicon Valley executives like Yelp's CEO Jeremy Stoppelman, is a star among free market advocates seeking to build new housing in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. Young YIMBY members attend planning board meetings and have launched lawsuits against California cities and towns to overturn housing restrictions. According to In These Times, YIMBYism has taken off during the recent housing crisis, where it is common for 40% of an individual's income to be spent on rent or mortgage payments in urban neighborhoods plagued by gentrification. Racial tensions have spiked as Trauss has compared Latino anti-gentrification activists to Trump supporters who oppose immigration. Housing activists like Maria Zamudio of the Plaza 16 Coalition see YIMBY activists as a front group for developers, landlords, and speculators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The study in contrast between the horrific violence on the Israel-Gaza border and the posh celebration of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem on May 14th couldn't have been more stark. As an estimated 50,000 Palestinians gathered along the frontier fence line in the sixth straight week of protests, Israeli army snipers opened fire, killing 58 people and injuring 2,700 more. This was the deadliest day since the Great March of Return protests began on March 30th, that are demanding an end to the 12-year Gaza blockade and the right to return to land now occupied by Israel. Since these protests began, at least 107 Palestinians have died, including children and journalists, and 12,000 others have been injured. While Israel justified the slaughter, asserting that protesters who attempted to damage or break through the border fence presented a threat to Israeli security, nations across the world have condemned Israel's use of excessive and disproportionate force. The deadly demonstrations coincided with the opening of the controversial new U.S. Jerusalem embassy on the 70th anniversary of Israel's founding and on the eve of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, May 15th, when Palestinians commemorate the date when 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled or fled from their homes during the 1948 Palestine War. Your reporter spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of militant protests and the subsequent massacre of civilians by Israeli soldiers at the Gaza-Israel border.
People in Gaza are basically imprisoned by Israel. It's not so much a border as it is a prison, in that people in Gaza can't get in and get out for the most part. Even on the Egyptian side, when outsiders try to get in to break that blockade, people have tried to get ships in there to try to give some breathing room to the over 1 million people repressed in Gaza that Israelis intercepted, occasionally killing of people who try to do that. So the circumstance in Gaza is dire constantly, and I think that that's part of the reason that you have people who are fundamentally saying, give me liberty or give me death. That's what these Palestinians are saying, that their lives have become so oppressive by what Israel has done for generations that they are willing to, you know, take these drastic actions that may well result in them being killed.
Sam, I did want to ask you about Israel's statements over these past 6 weeks and certainly today, justifying live sniper fire on what have been reported to be mostly or pretty much entirely unarmed civilians in a protest there at the border. Israel claims that the threat presented by these protesters, many of whom approached the border fence and some attempting to damage or cut through the border fence, was justification for the live sniper fire that has killed so many over the past 6 weeks.
I think that it violates an incredible number of legal precepts and ethical precepts. These people are only doing it because they're desperate and see no other recourse, because the international community has done virtually nothing for them, even though Israel has had them in this imprisoned situation for years and years. I heard the U.S. ambassador earlier today saying that they burn tires and, you know, they have kites. The Palestinians burn tires to prevent the view of the snipers so that the Israelis will have a little bit of a rougher time shooting and killing them. They are not a military or meaningful threat. They are, in a sense, a symbolic threat to the notion of an Israel that continuously oppresses. And what they're saying is, you've got us in this pen and you've prevented us from going to our homelands, and you'll shoot us if we try to, and you've made our lives so miserable here that we almost don't care anymore. We're just going to go to our homelands, and, you know, you shoot us, you shoot us. You know, as if Native Americans on the Trail of Tears, you know, decided to turn around and go back to their the homes that they were being forced from, and the U.S. military was shooting at them. You know, if that were to happen, Hollywood would make a very sympathetic movie about that.
Sam, with Trump's recent moves to relocate the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and full-bore support for expansion of Israeli settlements, it seems that any pretense of negotiations in the near future for a two-state solution is flat off the table. What does the future hold, given this powder keg that we've seen explode here on the Israel-Gaza border? What's next?
I think the so-called two-state solution, the U.S. as some kind of honest broker, has been a bit of something of a fantasy for some years now. And I think now it's gone beyond fantasy to, you know, an utter depraved joke. I was never a key signatory to it, but the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel has really been a grassroots movement that has genuinely put some pressure on Israel. And I really take my hat off to a lot of the activists who led the way on that. That's something that's very tangible, that people can do and they can plug into. And it's not just, you know, rhetoric. And I think that you're needing to see meaningful activism in countries like the United States, as well as new leadership emerging among Palestinian ranks in order to reassert their fundamental rights, because it literally is, you know, a matter of life and death for them, or perpetual servitude.
That was Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Find more news and commentary on the desperate conditions in Gaza and Israel's deadly attack on the Palestinian border protest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Trump-Russia investigation rolls on, much of it behind closed doors, new revelations made headlines when Michael Avenatti, adult film star Stormy Daniels' attorney, disclosed that several major U.S.-based and international corporations had made large payments to Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Avenatti is challenging the validity of the non-disclosure agreement that Daniels signed just before the 2016 presidential election, requiring her not to discuss an alleged affair she had with Trump in 2011. Avenatti released a report, much of it now verified, which stated that Michael Cohen's company, Essential Consultants, received $600,000 from AT&T, $1.2 million from pharmaceutical giant Novartis, $150,000 from Korea Aerospace, and $500,000 from Columbus Nova, an investment firm linked with Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg. These funds were deposited in the same LLC account from which Cohen paid Daniels $130,000 in hush money in October 2016. It's notable that all these companies that gave Cohen money had important business issues awaiting decisions from the U.S. federal government. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics. Here he examines the purpose and use of the multi-million-dollar slush fund that Michael Cohen controlled and the legality of corporate money flowing directly or indirectly to a president through a third party in order to gain influence.
I suspect that in this case, this may well be something that Trump had no knowledge of, that Cohen was looking for, you know, kind of a freelancing opportunity to sell access to the president. And he talked these companies into this proposition on the basis of, you know, every one of them that was involved here. We know certainly AT&T with its, Time Warner deal, Novartis with drug regulations. And, you know, they were firms that really needed to have an inside track on government regulation. You know, this wasn't a whole lot of money for them in the aggregate compared to the potential value of having access to the president. But, you know, the Times had a detailed profile of Cohen in which they went into many of his other dodgy connections going back in time, and his uncle involved with the Lucchese mob and operating El Caribe, a place in kind of a watering hole from a mafiosa. And Michael maintained an investment in that club until 2016 after the election. The more interesting and I think important relationship here was the Vekselberg relationship. Viktor Vekselberg is one of the richest people in Russia. He has intimate relationships with many of the other GARCs that have come up in this kind of last 2 years in the story, in the investigation, people like Dara Paska. Leo Blavatnik is a Russian-American who made a lot of donations to, you know, $6.3 million of political contributions to U.S. politicians in the 2016 election cycle. He's Vekselberg's partner and has been an investor with Dara Paska, who's implicated in the Michael Flynn matter and the Manafort investigation. So this is a kind of a tiny, very influential crowd that, you know, some say have been basically deployed to gain influence over the Trump administration. And so this is kind of consistent with my favorite theory about what's been going on, which is not so much that Trump is a kind of a mole on the part of Putin. There is a whole investigation of collusion that Mueller is doing. But I'm just more struck by this kind of long history of kind of mobster activity. I mean, it's kind of organized crime has had a long-term relationship with Trump and with some of the people around him.
For myself and our audience, I'd like you to discuss a bit about the money that was coming into Michael Cohen's LLC from large corporations like AT&T and Novartis. Michael Cohen, as I understand it, was not a registered lobbyist. So what's the legality of hundreds of thousands of dollars and even over $1 million that was pumped into that account by some of these corporations. Is this a legal transaction to buy access to the president, or at least what they thought was buying access?
Clearly, if Trump had known about Michael Cohen's fundraising activities here and had sent him out to shake down these companies in exchange for access, that would have been, I think, over the line. But where you have a case here that the companies are kind of responding to Michael's invitations, they're hiring him, for alleged consulting services. I think that, there's an argument that the president didn't even know about it. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but, we have to benefit of the doubt. So I think in this case, what we have is foolhardy behavior. It certainly has, impropriety written all over it. The avoiding, in terms of avoiding the appearance of impropriety, but it may be a case of where it's hard to prove that there was any kind of real exchange for services. In fact, just the opposite. These companies have come away with their kind of black eyes as a result of this, and it's not clear that he ever delivered anything. We may be on the verge of learning much more about a whole web of relationships that Michael Cohen was involved with. There was this strange meeting at the Trump Tower in December 2016 in which one of the senior investors from Qatar met with Michael Flynn and with Trump and also with Rick Perry, the Department of Energy cabinet executive in the U.S. And who knows what they were discussing, but the meeting happened just a couple days after this deal in which Qatar invested in the big Russian state-owned company Rosneft and basically helped to buy a transaction that involved about 20% of Rosneft. There are all kinds of allegations in the Steele memorandum for those of you who are really down in the weeds here on the Trump investigation. That transaction with the Qataris featured prominently, and there we have basically Cohen holding hands with all these people during this kind of very dubious meeting that day. So I suspect that we're going to find out much more about people that he maybe recruited, that he tried to recruit. But, this is a fellow who's been deeply involved in the Trump administration for at least a decade and probably longer. And, there's probably more to come out about him.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics. Find links to articles examining Trump-era pay-to-play schemes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut was one of many states and cities around the U.S. that raised money and awareness to bail women out of jails and prisons for Mother's Day this year. The Connecticut Bail Fund, working with a dozen other groups, raised about $30,000 and bailed out 30 women. The funds were used to bail out 26 women from the state's only women's prison, York Correctional Institute in Niantic, with another four bailed out from immigration jail. While these women are charged with crimes, they haven't been convicted and are incarcerated only because they can't afford to pay bail. The groups participating in the Mother's Day bailout, as it's called, are not simply raising money to release women from jail, but are challenging the entire money bail system, which discriminates against the poor, the population most frequently caught up in the criminal justice system. On May 8th, the coalition of groups taking part in the Mother's Day bailout held a rally in a park adjacent to the York Women's Prison, where advocates, including many formerly incarcerated women, shouted their encouragement to the women still behind bars. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and brings us excerpts of several of those who spoke.
Ana Maria Rivera Forestieri works at the Connecticut Bail Fund.
There's nearly 1,000 women that are currently incarcerated in this cage, in this state-sponsored cage, that are not going to be able to go home to their loved ones. And so throughout the last couple of months, through the work that we've been doing, and through the stories that some of which you're going to be hearing about today, we've been learning about the human rights abuses that women are experiencing inside this facility. And so we want to stand in love and solidarity, but we also want to shed light into what's happening right here in Connecticut. Some of the abuses that women are experiencing, from sexual harassment to sexual abuse to medical neglect, from immigration agents coming into this facility impersonating lawyers and tricking people. We want to let people know what's happening inside this facility. And we want to send a message of love and solidarity that we're here, that we love you, that we stand with you, that we're going to fight every single day until all of you come home to your communities.
Yes! Woo!
Repeat after me. It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and protect each other.
We must love and protect each other.
We have nothing to lose but our change.
Tehiba Bain yelled to the women inside York about a new state law to protect their rights.
I'm here today because I want to let the women at York know that for anyone that's in there that is pregnant, you have the right today to not be shackled during transportation.
Woo!
Throughout this past session of the legislation, we have been successful in passing Senate Bill 13 for an act of fair treatment for incarcerated women. You are now allowed and supposed to be provided sanitary napkins free of charge. The people that are pregnant, you're not supposed to be handcuffed, shackled during labor and after delivery. So know your rights, ladies. You have that right, and you have to fight for your right. I was in York CI many, many years ago, maybe 3 or 4 times. So today I want to, yes, I was. So today I want to let you know that even though you're behind that wall today, you can be out here tomorrow doing the same thing. And don't forget about the sisters that you leave when you do leave, because they're going to need your help like you need our help today.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Hi, my name is Nicole Kennedy. I was just released by the Bail Committee Fund on Friday. This program worked. I was picked up on a 2015 warrant and was incarcerated. The Bail Fund Committee came and got me Friday. April 7th, I did a praise dance in order to raise money to bring women home. You would have not told me I would be one of those women. Today, I stand here and I say, I'm free. Praise the Lord, I'm free. No more bounds, no more chains holding me. My soul is resting. It's a blessing. I'm free today to fight for other women that was in there with me, sat with me. 7 days in a medical locker. You go nowhere for 7 days. Your mental state of mind goes through torment. You don't know when you're getting out. You are a victim of the state. Today, my fear is, I went to court today, and my fear was they could revoke my bond if they feel like it and place me back in for heartaches of 3 years ago. My past is my past. Judge me for my present, because my past, I can't live by that anymore. You tell me to change, you tell me to rehabilitate, then leave my past in my past and judge me for my present. And that's why my presence is out here, to tell those ladies that watch me leave Friday, I am out here still fighting to get the rest of you out. I will not sit still, and I will not be quiet anymore, like I was told in those walls. I was told when to speak, when not to speak. And if I spoke, I was told to shut up. I had no value. I had no opinion. I had no say-so. Today, I got a lot to say. You will not treat us the way you have anymore. We have rights. We have the right to fight for what we believe in, and we believe in that these walls will no longer hold us back. I'm going forward to say thank you to this committee and these people that are out here rallying. Thank you for freeing me. You came and got me, so I need to come back and get the rest of them. Ladies, let's do this. Amen.
That was Anna Maria Forestieri, co-director of the Connecticut Bail Fund, to Heba Bain and Nicole Kennedy, speaking at a rally in solidarity with incarcerated women at Connecticut's York Correctional Institute on May 8th. Learn more about groups challenging the nation's money bail system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Rumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Let's now hear from a spokesman for the Tennessee Tea Party. This group attempted to remove references of American slavery and the fact that the vast majority of the country's founders were long-standing slave owners from school textbooks. My name is Hal Rounds, R-O-U-N-D-S, like 45 caliber rounds. I teach the Constitution coast to coast for tea parties. History textbooks contain an awful lot of made-up criticism about, for instance, the founders intruding on the Indians or having slaves or being hypocrites in one way or another. The thing we need to focus on about the founders is that, given the social structure of their time, they were revolutionaries who bought liberty into a world where it hadn't existed to everybody. Not all equally instantly, but it was their progress that we need to look at. Interesting to see and good to know that esteemed historians like Jan Lewis from Rutgers University, who's typical of the centurion standing guard over the status quo, and batshit crazy teabaggers, agree on the contextualization of the terrorism that was American slavery for almost 400 years. Richard Pryor also offers some insight on the contextualization of American slavery. Niggas be holding their dicks, Jack, and white people go, why you guys holding your things? Say you done took everything else, motherfucker. Unfortunately, as civilization followed the sun, many were blinded by the light. Slavery for us is defined by two concepts. One is straightforward economics, and the other has to do with flesh, blood, and terror, not the usual framing of American slavery that exists in the abstract. First, the economic definition, the imperialist conversion of humans into instruments for the production of goods. With this definition, slavery is a practical exercise in the commercial world, similar to any capitalist endeavor. Cheap labor, very cheap labor, coupled with the distribution of product. At the time, it was perfectly legal, morally acceptable, and great for business. What a windfall. You get your workforce for free. Jesus, the good old days. In fact, guys like James Madison jumped all over this great opportunity, boasting to a British friend that he made about $257 a year on every Negro slave he owned, and he only had to spend about $13 on his keep. other founding fathers took a real hands-on approach with their slaves, like old hothead Patrick Henry and his good buddy, signer of the Declaration of Independence, Richard Henry Lee, both of whom actively traded and whipped their slaves. These guys were really involved. They took pride in their small business ownership. Also, it's encouraging when the boss visits. Employees yearn to have their hard work affirmed. No defender of slavery, I concede that it has its benevolent aspects in lifting the Negro from savagery, in helping prepare him for that eventual freedom which is surely written in the book of fate, Thomas Jefferson. The second definition centers on slavery as physical and psychological terrorism, perpetrated not by, as history would have us believe, munificent and caring paternal white father figures like Jefferson, with his hope of civilizing these savages, savages that Jefferson had no problem fucking and fathering children by, but rather perpetrated by psychotic purveyors of violence for profit, who were then exonerated by scribes, then and now, absolved of any real crimes. It's just another classic case in the history of mankind of when the power elites make the unthinkable normal. They blame everything on us, but nerve enough to even blame slavery on us. They said, we didn't bring them over here. We went to Africa to get some elephants. Niggers just jumped in the boat, the ship. Take me, take me. Nigger, we don't want you. Get back, boy. And come on, take me, take me. All right, boy, we'll take you. What else you want to do? Put a chain on my leg so I don't slip off. Comedian Dick Gregory. The myth remains safe, and the whitewash of history not only pardons these scoundrels for crimes against humanity, it actually vindicates their evil actions. If the reality were actually contemplated to its core, the force of this terror would shake every foundation this nation rests on. One would be forced to come face to face with a reality that would include the following highlights. The theft of human beings from their home, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, who were then shackled and transported on slave ships that can only be described as beyond shocking, where conditions would make a maggot vomit, pure and unadulterated horror. When this journey through hell ended on the pristine shores of America, these so-called animal savages, in reality, the brave and resilient human beings lucky enough not to have been clubbed to death and tossed in the Atlantic, then began the multi-generational nightmare of misery and anguish, human bondage, bought and sold away from your family on a master's whim, whippings, beatings, bludgeoning, vicious rapes, tarring and feathering, castration, the removal of limbs for what were called minor infractions, forced to fight human cockfights, hangings, more hangings, and of course, executions on demand. And then you wake up the next day and do it all over again. Now, in case we forget the real and lasting terrorism of slavery, let's add the psychological hell to the physical hell. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the most prolific advocates of exposing the long-term psychological toll caused by slavery and its monstrous practices. Practices like selective breeding, which helped to ensure that the master had an ongoing supply of strong slaves capable of performing superhuman feats. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. No, it's Superman Dingo. The sheer terrorism that was American slavery is another clear-cut tunnel that runs unbridled through American history, responsible for devastating an incalculable number of families, their structure and value debased and obliterated well into the future, into the present. This befouling and malignant behavior begs the rhetorical question. What was the base motivation to terrorize a people for centuries? W.E. Burghardt Du Bois reminds us once again, for it can never be overstated. Both Europe and the earlier colonists themselves regarded this land as existing chiefly for the benefit of Europe. and as designed to be exploited as rapidly and ruthlessly as possible of the boundless wealth of its resources. This was the primary excuse for the rise of the African slave trade to America. W.E.B. Du Bois. You've been listening to an excerpt from Murder Incorporated, Book 1, Dreaming of Empire, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria.
How does money from philanthropic foundations distort social and environmental movements? What unique role do the NGOs Avaaz and Purpose serve in fostering support for Western imperialist hegemony in the Global South? What are the limits to dissent among foundation-funded media? What are the new frontiers of social movement co-optation? How can grassroots activist movements overcome the influence of big moneyed interests? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we speak to two researchers who have studied the so-called nonprofit industrial complex and its impacts on grassroots efforts to challenge the powers that be. My guests are London-based writer and investigative journalist Corey Morningstar and Boston-based blogger and investigative journalist Bob Feldman. On this week's program, the nonprofit industrial complex and the parallel left, a conversation with Corey Morningstar and Bob Feldman. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 11th, 2018. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our programs are available at the website globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Following Netanyahu's speech, the White House released a statement of its own, saying Israel's intelligence confirms what the U.S. had already known, that, quote, Iran has a robust clandestine nuclear weapons program that it has tried and failed to hide from the world, unquote. Not long after, the White House issued a second statement that changed the word has to had, appearing to suggest that Iran no longer possesses a nuclear weapons program. However, a White House official later explained to NBC News that the wrong tense was the result of a quote-unquote clerical error. Either way, despite the uncompromising anti-Iranian narrative, the prevailing truth appears to be that Iran is in full compliance with the JCPOA, and the main officials involved, including Trump and Netanyahu, are well aware of this. In his April 12th Senate confirmation hearing, then-CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who this week began his tenure as Secretary of State, said he has, quote, seen no evidence that they, Iran, are not in compliance today, unquote. That comes from the article, Iran Isn't Violating the JCPOA Nuclear Agreement, America Is, by Darius Shatamasebi, posted May 4th, originally appearing at the Anti-Media. On Tuesday, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, issued an assessment in response to Netanyahu's speech firmly asserting that there are, quote, no credible indications, unquote, supporting Netanyahu's claims of a continued Iranian nuclear weapons program after 2009. According to the AP summary of the IAEA assessment, the UN nuclear agency says it believes that Iran had a coordinated nuclear weapons program in place before 2003, but found no credible indications of such work after 2009. The documents focused on Iranian activities before 2003 and did not provide any explicit evidence that Iran has violated its 2015 nuclear deal with the international community. The IAEA statements followed on the heels of a number of international Iran analysts weighing in to say there appeared nothing new in terms of evidence, which Netanyahu confidently presented as if it were an open and shut bombshell revelation of Iranian malfeasance. That comes from the article, Trump all but decided to withdraw from Iran deal as IAEA refutes Netanyahu's speech, posted May 3rd, originally appearing at Zero Hedge. What Netanyahu said about the Iranian nuclear program was chestnut. Since the mid-1990s, he is repeating this worn-out stuff like a mantra. He didn't present a single new argument, but for Donald Trump, it will be enough evidence to ultimately scarp the nuclear deal, what he wanted to do from day one of his presidency. The last person in his administration, Defense Secretary James Mattis, still sticks to reality and has declared many times that the Iranian government upholds its obligations. Since Trump kicked out the last moderate members of his cabinet, the U.S. embarked on a course of a war. That comes from the article, Netanyahu's Anti-Iranian Reality TV Show, by Dr. Ludwig Watzal, posted May 1st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. My name is Michael Welch, and the program is the Global Research News Hour, recording this week's interview from Radio Western CHRW 94.9 FM here at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabeg, Haudenosaunee, Lunapiwak, and Attawandaron peoples. Many listeners of this program are by now familiar with the role of corporate advertising in shaping the content and focus of mainstream media broadcasts. Along with the manufacture of consent of the body politic goes the manufacture of dissent, where social, labor, environmental, anti-war movements get co-opted in sophisticated ways. One of the principal mechanisms by which the process is orchestrated is through what is called the nonprofit industrial complex, a web of NGOs interconnected with state and corporate entities which channel activist energies in directions that ultimately don't undermine and more often than not further the ambitions of the elite of the elite. Corey Morningstar is all too familiar with this dynamic. She has written about the NPIC for close to a decade now. Corey Morningstar is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist. Her recent writings can be found on Wrong Kind of Green, The Art of Annihilation, Political Context, Counterpunch, Canadians for Action on Climate Change, and Countercurrents. She joins us here at the studios of Radio Western. It's great to chat with you again, Corey.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
And joining us by phone from Boston, Massachusetts, is Bob Feldman. And Bob is he's also an investigative journalist, and he is, for more than a decade, he has been researching the role of philanthropic foundation funding in compromising the perspectives of the alternative print and broadcast media that depend on such funding for their operations. So thank you for joining us, Bob.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
For the sake of those who might be skeptical-minded, what would you say to those people who say, well, there's no quid pro quo? I mean, it's great that the Rockefellers or the DuPonts or whoever donate this money. I mean, we got it. We need that money if we're going to, you know, stop this pipeline or we're going to get the messaging out or set up this website.
But all you have to do is look at what progress have we made. We have made no progress. I mean, emissions are through the roof. What are we at now? 410 parts per million. You know, countries are being all over. You've got U.S., NATO states all over the whole globe conquering, invading, occupying. You know, like we've made no progress. I know.
Yeah, the thing about it is that it's since the early 1970s that the foundation money has been pouring in, trying to convert the environmentalist movement into, you know, sustainable development. I mean, Joan Roelof, in her book Foundations and Public Policy,
oh, yeah,
mentions this fact, you know, I mean, Natural Resources Defense Council, CERA, you know, Club Legal Defense, all these groups, they've gotten this foundation money, yet it's 50 years later, and it hasn't achieved the reversal. So we have to ask ourselves, why? Why has the movement, you know, why do we end up with Trump in 2017, 2018, you know? And there's a lot of, I mean, a lot of the information is, there's a new book out by David Callahan, he's Inside Philanthropy, he's the editor, and it's called The Giver's Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. And he has a sentence I'd like to read because it kind of summarizes what's happened. He says, you know, he says like progressives always talk about the right wing being funded by the right wing foundations and correctly criticize that. But he also said, but he has this quote. He says progressives have been largely silent about how, quote, charitable and quote dollars are influencing politics and policy, often with deeper impact than the campaign spending the left so fervently wants to restrict. You can see why progressives keep mum on this issue. Its advocates are especially dependent on philanthropy. And, you know, I mean, growing up, I thought, well, foundations, you know, they're helping the people. And then I read C. Wright Mills' book, The Power Leap, in which he mentioned, well, foundations are a tax dodge. And so, you know, I thought, well, yeah, but maybe they're still helping to fund good things. But then 50 years ago, you know, in 68 at Columbia, and, you know, the radical students, SDS, you know, in alliance with Harlem and the Afro-American Society, they took over and we made some demands. And then there's a police bust. And then everyone was radicalized. Everyone was talking revolution on the campus. Then what happened is that to split the students, the moderates from the revolutionary students, the Ford Foundation came in with a $40,000 grant for students to fund students for a restructured university. And the idea was that SDS was saying that what we wanted is we wanted a revolutionary society, a society free of militarism, free of racism. But the Students for Restructured Society, funded by the Ford Foundation, they said, no, let's just focus on changing the university, limiting the demands. And at that point, it was a $40,000 grant, which is equivalent to $300,000 in 2018 money. And at that point, I realized that, hey, this is what the foundations are about, manipulating movements, insurgent movements. And today, of course, you have not only example of the, you know, what wrong kind of green articles that Corey has written, explained, but you also have in terms of Black Lives Matter and, you know, center, the Color of Change, for instance, got in 2017 $7.5 million, you know. So it's an attempt to limit, you know, and manipulate what kind of issues the activists are going to prioritize and what their tactics are going to be. Because if they get too out of the parameters of what the agenda of those who control the foundations are, and the foundations themselves are directed off my corporate directors, then the funding ends.
What you're saying there is quite interesting, and you're speaking of that split, a split between the kind of resistance they can live with and the kind that, you know, we want to try to eclipse. And Corey, I just wanted to turn to you if you could maybe help us visualize the difference that you see this foundation money making as it's playing out, like what the environmental movement could be without the foundation money's intrusion versus what we're seeing coming out now.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you look back and, I mean, I wasn't there, but you read about even the Black Panthers and their breakfast programs and actually tangible things in the community, right? And now today it's like, well, I'm going to give $50 to Greenpeace this year. I've done my part. I mean, we've lost that sense of community and working with each other as adults, as parents, as humans, where we need to take responsibility for our own issues. We've basically, I think been happy to give these problems on to the NGOs as part of it. So, and like Bob was saying too, with the money, there's a lot of conditions. And so you get people, you don't even have to censor and, the people involved, the journalists, the NGOs, they've become adept at self-censorship. And a lot of these millions of dollars given happen, there are 5 years. I mean, you get a certain amount every year. So, if you bite the hand that feeds you, that money, that check will not be there the following year.
I know that there was a report that came out a few years ago by McDonald Stainsby and Drew Oyejay that commented on foundation funding and how it's distorted tar sands activism. And so we don't see the level of opposition to tar sands as a result.
Yeah, I mean, the tar sands, one way or another, that oil will make it to the market where there's a demand. That oil, like water through a pipe, will find its way one way or another to escape. Eventually, it finds a route to get out. And that what we don't talk about is, if we don't want oil, what are we willing to give up? Well, in fact, we're willing to give up nothing, because that would put a damper on economic growth, and you need economic growth to keep this economic system going. Capitalism, if it stalls, it collapses. So we can't have that. So this whole focus on the pipelines, you've got thousands of pipelines all over the whole planet, and we put all the focus on North America on a single pipeline. Well, then oil quietly in the background all switches to rail. And then you've got Warren Buffett ends up making billions, tens and tens of billions of dollars on rebuilding a rail dynasty in North America while everyone's focused on a single pipeline, right? No one notices it's all being done in the background, and there's absolutely no dissent to that. And then that horrible, horrible accident in Montreal that killed almost 50 people from the oil. The rail accident with the oil. I mean, now we have the same thing happening in BC. We've got oil being diverted to Portland and being put onto ships to Asia. I mean, the oil's going to get to the market. So to not look at this, what is the purpose? Do we want to stop this pipeline, or do we want to stop oil? If we want to stop oil, what are we willing to give up? What are we willing, wanting to discontinue? And the nonprofit industrial complex, the NGOs, that have the basically take up all the breathing room on the space, they don't want you to give up anything. I mean, there's no talk really of changing the way we live in the West. The fact of the matter is, here, 1% of the population's creating almost all the emissions on the planet. There's a tiny percentage of people doing all the damage. We don't talk about that, So we're not talking about systemic change. We're talking about how can we have everything we already have, plus have a lot more, and do it in a clean, environmentally, ecologically sound way. Well, there is no way. Right?
Yeah, and I know, Bob, you... it seems to me, I mean, you've got a series out right now on your blog, wherechangeobama.blogspot.ca. And I know that in one of the it's part of a 14-part series. I think there are more coming. But I think you did mention that there was some awareness way back when about the dangers of this kind of funding. And that I don't know if the awareness just went away, or if people became indifferent. I mean, what have been the changes, or when did you see this, acceptance of foundation funding as a perhaps a necessary evil or a vehicle for this, for pursuing whether it's media or activism?
Started to a certain degree in terms of the Black Liberation Movement in the late 60s, they posed a systemic threat. And then the Ford Foundation came in and started, and Rockefeller Foundation started funding black capitalism, you know, and poured in lots of money to the Urban League, NAACP. And then within the anti-war movement and peace movement, I think it started in terms of maybe the 80s nuclear freeze. And so you had the sad thing that at that point in the early 80s, 800,000 people marched against nuclear war in June of 1982. And then there was a contingent saying, well, the Israeli military is invading, it's bombing Beirut, is invading Lebanon. We're for peace. That should be a priority also of this march. And there was a contingent saying that, but then the organizers said, no, you can't talk about opposing the Israeli militarism. And then the late 80s and 90s, early 90s, that's when groups like Pacifica started seeking the foundation funding, and then alternative media groups started to seek it and get it.
I mean, look at Democracy Now beating the drums for war on Libya. And I mean, I don't listen to Democracy Now, but I'm pretty sure Syria as well. I mean, look at the so-called left beating drums for war. You know, like, that's unbelievable. In this day and age, like, how can we fall for the same stories, you know, rinse, recycle, repeat, like basically the same old stories over and over for so-called humanitarian intervention. And we have the left, the liberal left, you know, journalists and liberal left media, you know, completely, again, like echoing through the chambers, these pro-war propaganda.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that on Libya, Syria, and also in 1999 on the quote humanitarian military intervention in Serbia, Yugoslavia, it didn't echo Michael Parenti's opposition. It took a different stand. Democracy Now, which demonized Milosevic. You know, which echoed, I mean, it was opposed to the war, but it echoed aspects of what the Democratic Party and the State Department was saying. And part of it is because on situations like Libya and Syria and 9/11 and and the 1999 war, if you get too, if you appear too anti-war and not willing to concede certain points about that the media is pushing about the illegitimacy of the regime that the U.S. government wants to change, whether it's Syria or Libya or in Serbia, then the funders, you know, the funding goes. And it's self-censorship, really. Yeah. It isn't that it isn't that Bill Moyers, who's given 1.1 million since 2013 to fund Democracy Now, his Schuman Media Center. Isn't that he's going to say, tell you not to do a lot of investigative reporting segments after 2013, 50 years after the Kennedy assassination? Have like a whole series on Democracy Now. But the reality is that since he's funding Democracy Now, and since Bill Moyers was LBJ's aide for 3 years after Kennedy was assassinated, he maybe doesn't want that emphasized. And then since he's Bill Moyers, who's redefined himself since that time, you know, people, they just won't get into that. And then anybody who thinks, well, we should explore these particular historical events in greater detail, they're either called conspiracy theorists, or the other thing is Johnny OneNotes. The listeners aren't aren't interested in, you know. But I think the thing about the foundations is that early in the 20th century, there was a lot of criticism on the left of foundations because it was seen as undemocratic. It was seen as, well, Rockefeller, Carnegie, they got their money by exploiting workers in vicious ways, exploiting consumers in vicious ways, unethical business practices, making weapons of death in some cases. And these plutocrats shouldn't then be able to redefine themselves and fund groups on it was undemocratic, that their power should be taken away. But you've got a situation now where they make their money in immoral means, and they continue to, the foundations also invest in those corporations that are responsible for the destruction of the earth and for systemic racism and for militarism. The foundations still have investments in those corporations, and at the same time they use some of the profits, the dividends they get from those investments to fund the groups which purportedly are either reporting on the, you know, on the harm done by the corporations or fighting against the policies, the results of the policies of these corporations. And what's left off the hook is the foundations themselves are tied in with the systemic problems that people want to see eradicated. It's a way, and the foundations become a means of the 1% to block structural and systemic change.
I think our movements represent very much a part of that same 1%. I mean, the staff at Avaaz make around $200,000 a year. I mean, we're talking elite status, and you can look straight across the board, Sierra Club, all the big ones. They're making huge six-figure salaries, you know, some of them $400,000 or $500,000 a year. And then they're asking seniors to send in, you know, their checks for $5 a month. I mean, it's
Oh, yeah, Democracy Now! is a good example. Like, I glanced at it today before the early in the morning, and I noticed they say, well, if you send in our money, a supporter will match it three times, but they don't name their supporter.
Exactly.
The supporter. At the same time, they don't disclose on their website the amount of money that they've received in recent years from various foundations, like the former vice president of Microsoft for 10 years, Rob Glaser, his foundation, the Glaser Progress Foundation. They've given 15 since 2001, $1.2 million, you know, to fund Democracy Now! And Democracy Now!, you know, I don't think it's done that many segments on exposing the negative role historically and even currently of Microsoft. It's work for the military. Microsoft, for instance, just got a $927 million contract to work for the Pentagon, provide software. Help the Pentagon do what it's doing around the world. And part of why they might not do it is because at one point, one of their chief funders was involved with Microsoft for 10 years, you know, helped build it up. But part of why all the other thing is also the economic thing is that Amy Goodman, gets $160,000 a year, you know, total compensation. Most people don't know that. The salaries... I mean, you had to get the salaries. You have to go look on Form 990 that all these NGOs file, and it's often hard to, you know, it's not easy to find because a lot of people either aren't going to look on it, and often the forms aren't completely filled out or not filled out until later. But there's, you know, like Corey says, there's a lot of money within this NGO world, this nonprofit industrial complex. It matches, enables people to, without working in a 9-to-5 world, you get an alternative job and live quite well, not live on the average salary of most movement activists who are grassroots or on most working people, you know, in the world, you know, not even in the United States, you know.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
That cuts you off from the broader grassroots community because you're sort of in a separate world where you're more inclined to mingle with some of those elites than with the feel that same sense of solidarity.
Also, the other thing is, let's say we're in a movement group. If we all sit in the room and we all, we're doing it, people are like, working 9 to 5 and then they go in the evening. But then somebody else is one person in the room, if you're talking about, well, what are we going to do, about fighting what this corporation is doing or on this issue. The person in the room who's backed as part of the NGO, has the economic basis to have more influence, and has, over what's going to happen, there's a group called Plowshares, for instance, Plowshares Fund, and they focus on stopping nuclear war. And, they've gotten, since 2015, they've gotten $2.7 million from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And then what they do is then they distribute it to a lot of grantees. If you go to their website, you can see all their grantees that they distribute. And, like 20 of them within the peace movement, and most of those grantees just focus on the nuclear war issue and don't focus on the wars that are being waged now that aren't that don't involve nuclear weapons.
Yeah, because you can't talk about imperialism, right?
Yeah, exactly right, and that's the common thing that. The instead of building an anti-imperialist revolutionary movement that would go against the system, you have the foundations. You use the NGOs, thousands of NGOs that end up fragmenting the movement. And the funny part is that when Bernie Sanders ran in 2016, he talked about political revolution. He didn't talk about economic revolution. He didn't talk about other kinds of revolutions that we need, but he used the word revolution. I was thinking when he ran that all these, if you listen to Democracy Now! and a lot of these other media's mother, this and there's rarely any talk of allowing people who are calling for revolution now against the 1%, using that word day in and day out, calling for an economic political revolution, And instead you have a mindset which is what I call the 30-year, gradualism, Yet the thing is, we need immediate change. The Poor People's Movement is talking about they're going to have their demonstrations Monday beginning, trying to continue what Martin Luther King did in 68. It's gotten some publicity in the alternative media world. And to an extent, it has some foundation funding. But it talks about the four things that people could be focusing on, which again, fighting systemic racism, fighting environmental destruction, fighting poverty, and finally fighting the war economy. Those four things people could unite on. But yet, because we have all these thousands of NGOs, and it's fragmented, movement, foundation-subsidized movement, people don't unite in a way that they did in the 60s around fighting a imperialist society that's trying to keep the empire, and is responsible for so many deaths the last 30 years, and then, of course, even before. And so you don't have kind of reaction that they should have been when they attacked Libya, and in terms of the covert war in Syria, that instead, NGO offices in a fragmented way and then calling demonstrations about this issue, that issue, this issue, that issue. And yet if you look at the starvation and the cost for the economic cost of imperialism around the globe, yet there isn't this sense of urgency. And I attribute part of it is because if each year the grant comes through to the NGO and then the NGO, calls its protests and gets some people out, it's a different form of activism than what we historically had. And it's undemocratic because what's driving it is still the same plutocrats who control the corporations.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour. This week's show is dedicated to the non-profit industrial complex and the parallel left, and it's being recorded out of the studios at Radio Western CHRW 94.9 FM at the University of Western Ontario. And our show, of course, airs on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. I'm your host, Michael Welch, and I'm joined by London-based Corey Morningstar and from Boston, Bob Feldman. And, of course, following up on your last comments there, Bob, I wanted to draw attention to some of the work that a couple of essays that Corey had written last year. And I'm just going to pull up a quote because it speaks to not only propagandizing but social engineering. Here's the quote. Today's so-called environmental leaders and human rights activists are not yet genetically engineered. Rather, they are socially engineered experiments decanted from Harvard, Yale, Rockwood Leadership Institute, and other institutions of indoctrination that serve and expand the global hegemony. One could theorize that today's 21st century activism is a new process of mimesis, the millennial having assimilated into spectacle, far removed from both nature and reality. So I'm just wondering, maybe just your thoughts about this idea that, I mean, we're not just talking about propaganda lines where, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, we got to go to war. We're talking about shaping people's behavior. So could I maybe get you to address that and how you've seen this
evolving? It's like redefining. I mean, what's been redefined is what fighting the power is about, what creating meaningful changes. I mean, what's been thrown into the what's been forgotten is the whole history of institutional resistance, just as what's been forgotten is how the funders and the foundations have gotten that money. It's ahistorical. I mean, I'm writing about foundations for since 1996. I wrote for Downtown, which wasn't funded by foundations, and this time around, what I kind of realized in terms of writing it in the pay of foundations is I couldn't just mention, well, it gets foundation funding, and therefore, hey, it's a synthetic kind of and a kind of morally contradictory, that people wouldn't necessarily understand. I had it like, because a lot of people they don't understand on gut level that, well, why foundations? What's so bad about foundations? So I kind of included more research as to, well, how did Henry Ford get his money? What did he do? How was the Ford Foundation funded? What's its history? Or something like the Public Welfare Foundation. Where did that money come from? What did they do? How did Charles Marsh, who was LBJ's backer in Texas and into oil, how did he get his money? And to try to get that, but I think that's part of the thing is that people are the people who grew up in my time, 50s and 1960s, were socialized a little differently than the people who were socialized later and then went to, like you say, there's a whole thing of the whole prep schools and the elite. Most people don't know that Bill Gates, for instance, His grandfather on his mother's side, Maxwell, was a big banker. Actually, the great-great-great-great-grandfather. And the grandfather was also into banking, ever since the State Bank, and left him a trust fund. This whole Silicon Valley thing and the whole computer millionaires, part of the thing is that they've used, it's funny because they've used the rhetoric of the 60s that we're changing the world to perpetuate a vicious imperialist system, you know. And they get away with it because the thing you mentioned in terms of the elite students at all these elite universities being socialized in a certain way, you know, and then also coming from a different generation than the 50s and 60s, they, you know.
I think people today think that history doesn't matter, that it's in the past, it's irrelevant, things aren't anymore, right? But the truth is these foundations are invisible, you know, that the NGOs are at the forefront and they play an invisible role. And today they're more powerful than they've ever been in the past. There's trillions, literally trillions of dollars pumped into the nonprofit industrial complex, which at this point, I mean, I was speaking to my peer, my comrade Forrest Palmer, a couple weeks ago, and I said, you know, I feel like we need to start calling this the nonprofit industrial spectacle. I mean, it's just become absolutely ridiculous. There's a new NGO of late I've sort of started watching called Global Citizen. They actually, if you can imagine, they have rewards now for activism. Like, think of air miles, all those points rewards that you use to shop. So activism has been completely commodified to the point now the partners and sponsors involved with Global Citizen will reward you for doing an action with rewards, whether it's concert tickets. It's all tied into celebrity, which is a huge part of activism. Not to mention, aside, this really is the nonprofit industrial complex is an actual army. Right? This is an arm of empire. This is an army that's funded and paid for by the elites that fund this complex to perpetuate and protect and further their power, to extend it even further. And I think that's really important to understand. That's what it's for. That's why the trillions of dollars. And they can mobilize their army. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it's actually staggering how many people are employed by NGOs and nonprofits, all which, you know, make up the nonprofit industrial complex. It's a massive part of the economy, just like militarism. And so they're able to really, really shape and mold entire agendas and actually whole society by mobilizing their employees, their staff. I mean, you picture, think of millions of people all basically echoing the same message through the media and, you know, the all the different media vices. And all of a sudden you've created this huge, what feels like momentum, but it's all engineered.
Yeah.
You know, hence our how we continue to devolve and how our movements continue to lose importance.
Corey, I just wanted to draw to, because I read like last year you did an update on your research on Avaaz and purpose, which you know, purpose is like they're linked, and they are very notable because it links the environmentalism with the imperialist agendas in Syria, and so I was just wondering because that is. It seems to me it's taking that social engineering to a new level.
I mean, okay, so if you look back, there's an old photograph I found. It's Bob Hunter, one of the original co-founders of Greenpeace in Canada. He has a T-shirt on, and on the T-shirt he has written across black marker, you, and he's at a meeting, right? He's sitting in on a meeting. He's all scruffy. It looks like he just came in from the garden or from work. I mean, you know, that was the real deal back then, about real things, you know, protecting nature. Now today, Greenpeace is at the forefront, right up there with Avaaz, Oxfam. There's like basically a top 20 that works hand in hand with the UN and, you know, basically run the social movements across the world, mold them, shape them. Social engineering, tick, tick, tick. Like basically Greenpeace, 350, and Oxfam, which are the three biggest, created tick, tick, tick. They took this type of social engineering to a whole new level in 2000. When was that? 2009 at COP21. You saw them basically undermine all the most vulnerable states in the planet at that climate conference, you know, and you look back at documents, Greenpeace documents from around 1990, where they cited 1 degree as a temperature that the planet could not exceed. Well, in 2009, they demanded a full 2 degrees, what the corporations wanted. So we continue to grow the economy at the expense of all life on the planet. So you can see that huge, you know, like it's not even the same thing anymore. These NGOs are an arm of the elite. They're an apparatus of the establishment and empire. So Avaaz and Purpose. Purpose is the for-profit PR firm, basically the sister org of Avaaz. I would say they're the most powerful NGO in the world, aside from 350, which was incubated by the Rockefeller Foundation and started with the Rockefeller Foundation and the Clinton Foundation. And again, that's hand in hand with Avaaz, one of the most powerful NGOs in the world right now as well. Anyway, I mean, what they do now, we've been engineered to such an extent that we don't even notice. We no longer fight to protect nature, to protect trees. We're fighting for windmills. We're fighting for solar panels. We're fighting to continue a very rich way of life for a small number of people. That's what the environment movement is today. And that's what I call not environmentalism, but
Post-centrism?
Anthropocentrism. It's completely, it's pragmatism. I mean, it's full. This is business. This is big business. Now you've got Avaaz, Purpose. The main overall arching campaign of all of them now is this huge push for renewable energies, which is actually a huge push for further imperialism. Mm-hmm. You know, you can call it green imperialism, eco-imperialism. It's just as dirty. It's just another growth industry, you know, and today they want to basically you know, steal from the treasuries, and now we're going to pump trillions and trillions, about $60 trillion, $90 trillion into creating a brand new, basically, global infrastructure, renewable energy, which is, what's that based on? That's based on further exploitation, further of you know, brothers and sisters all over the planet, mining, all dirty industry, further industry for a very few, you know, people.
Yeah, beyond the fact that lithium mining is not necessarily without its toxic concerns, and of course, and other rare earth minerals, which is mining. This call for electrification of the grid. Likely going to do anything.
No, I mean, I think you've got Bill McKibben right now in Africa, flying to Africa. What do they need Bill McKibben in Africa for? I don't know. But they've got him, you know, what was the article? I don't know, Rolling Stone, New York Times, what have you, saying how amazing it was that he was in Africa and on this little village with, you know, their few solar panels or whatever they have now, they all have a TV. Well, what the hell do they need a TV for, right? Like, that's progress. You know, I mean, it's just upside down now with technology and our values, you know, and what we see as progress. And,
that whole rap that Corey gave, it's like, that's the kind of thing that should be talked about on the foundation subsidized, you know, shows that are on daily, like Democracy Now. I mean, that's the thing is, yet if you start talking about the NGO, you know, and the foundations, that doesn't happen as much, and so you get a situation where people don't necessarily know what's going on, and so that undercuts the whole original mission of what an alternative left media was supposed to be about. You know, when you're not allowing a lot of dissident grassroots movement people on there.
So I think
that's what's holding back, and what has held back, you know, especially the last 20 years, has held back the growth of a movement that's really effective, you know.
I think we're running pretty much close to the end of our time. I was wondering if each of you might want to have a few suggestions about, you know, if we wish to hold on or foster movements and media that are not to be captured by these elite interests with their hegemonic agendas. What advice would you make for in terms of being able to do that, to maintain that sovereign and, make sure that we do make room for these dissenting voices?
I'll go first because I'm probably far less optimistic than Bob. I don't really have a lot of hope for that. I don't think anything's going to change a lot until it has to change, some sort of catastrophic event or some sort of collapse, which will eventually happen because this can't go on forever. But I feel like, I often wonder if we've just been socially engineered to be so incredibly passive, you know, like perhaps we're not even, you know, we've just, we don't even have the capacity anymore to really, you know, fight the fight. We're just so incredibly passive and polite. And that's, you know, all a part of social engineering. Even the, you know, even that aspect in the whole, direct action thing versus, you know, you can't even talk about tactics. Like, it can only be nonviolent direct action. Well, you know, and basically, if you have anything else to say but that, you're ostracized, you know, and basically outcast. You're isolated completely. I mean, you can't ask what is the Asada Shakur code. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but basically you're begging your oppressor, you know, for to do what you want. Like, I mean, it's just never going to happen. And so I think we're really, really comfortable here. I don't see things changing. We're being trained to devolve where we're not educating ourselves, we're not seeking out information, we're becoming mentally lazy. You know, it's too much work to research, it's too much work to learn. You know, you want all your information in 140 characters, you know, and without the history, without understanding the history of where we've been, of where the environmental movement's been, the history, the critical importance of the foundations and the interlocking dictate, like, and unless we understand how power functions and how it can use us to advance its own, you know, its own desires, I think we're really just spinning our wheels.
Mm. Hey, Bob, do you have any thoughts about, you know, preserving a truly independent media and grassroots activism going forward?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that things can change, you know, very rapidly. I mean, you had the Occupy Wall Street thing, which initially came from at least a lot of the people from below, you know, and then you pushed the idea of the 1%. Now, the you know, media has the alternative media. If people press them, at the same time engage in what I call institutional resistance, some of the system is in crisis worldwide. You know, it's in crisis here, and the way I look at it is that the exclusion of grassroots dissident, radical left, environmentalists, and others is a sign of the weakness and the fear of those of the 1%, those who hold power. Because if they weren't afraid that if they gave us access, there'd be a response, you know, to prove that how liberal and tolerant they were, they'd allow these kinds of discussions within their alternative media world and within the mainstream media world, you know. But I think the fact that there is this high level of censorship, the fact that, you know, Global Research News, you know, all those people who are on there and who get posted there, but you never hear them on Democracy Now!, you know, and the other shows, you know, I think that's because there'd be a response. And things can change very rapidly. I mean, we can be in a big war. And at that point, there'll be an attempt to co-opt the movement, you know. But often that doesn't work. I mean, the lessons of '68 shows that they couldn't co-opt, at least for the 2 years from '68 to '70. You know, they had to then repress. So I think that history can change fast, and the level of crisis in terms of the earth, you know, is so dire that people might be forced to press for more immediate change. I guess
maybe,
I'm not.
Maybe when they have to change.
Yeah.
Change.
I mean, I guess I'm not as pessimistic as you are. The key thing, as I see it, is we have to is using the mass media power and that alternative media to, you know, pressing those who have the daily access to the 1,400